Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Oh boy, here we go again. I love doing this. This is so much fun. This is like a dream come true. So every day I get to turn on the microphone and crank up and sit here and tell everything that I want to tell. I mean, it's hysterical to be able to do this. I mean, it really is. So all you folks that are thinking and dreaming and sitting out there saying, I want to do this, I want to do that, well, get off your butts and do it. You know, don't wait. There's no tomorrow or the next day. Start now. Start today. You know, and amazing things will happen. Like with our new government inquiry reporter, Brianna Cannon. She did it. She came on the show, and now she's got her own report. These things happen. I don't quite have a theme for her, so let's have a little bit of fun here. Let's do something a bit dramatic. And this is my Brianna, my new interjection to you. And now, Government Inquiry with Brianna Cannon. How's that? Good morning.
Sounds fun.
See, I got buttons. I got things. I got sound effects. I can do anything I want here. It's really kind of cool. Well, welcome back. Thank you. Thank you for coming back to the show here. And let's see what's on your mind as far as government inquiry. Questions that nobody else is asking, and I'll try and give you answers that nobody else has thought of. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
Okay, great. So, what you got for me? Let's get right into it.
So, the first thing is something else that was talked about at Patriot Academy, which seems to be a very constant theme, and it's the war on language today.
I'm sorry, I have to laugh. I'm not laughing at you. It's just that we make up so many of our own terms here that I'm going to be able to give you something to be able to send back to some other folks. In fact, I have to look up something now on Facebook that I made for a friend of mine. So actually it's Derek Park who was asking the exact same question. You know, but he says, you use some unusual terms here. Friday, I was talking about the GOP as the gelding old party. And he just laughed hysterically. He says, do you have any other ones of those? I said, well, actually, I do. Then I started writing them down. So I'm going to go pull those up right now on my phone because I try not to use too much computer capacity during the show. So tell me about language. What came up in Patriot Academy, and what is your fascination with it?
So throughout time, words have been, I guess people have an opinion of words that they think are wrong, or they try and change the definition to a different meaning because it's used one way by certain people or some people. Mm-hmm. And those definitions have changed in what people think of it. But the definition of the actual word itself hasn't changed, but it's changed in how people think of it. And now people are like, oh, you can't say those words. You can't say those words. And it's a very constant thing. Mm-hmm. And it's just, oh, we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. Oh, we don't want anybody to think that. And the problem is we can't do that because what will happen if we continue to change the definitions is that nothing will really have a true meaning anymore. Like, words won't have any true meaning anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So something that was talked about is that you have to use all of the words that you have and that you want to use in the correct definitions. Like, you can't be scared to say any words if somebody doesn't even know the correct definition.
This is fascinating. You are absolutely right on. I'm just taking a bunch of notes because what you're saying is incredibly important. Yeah, I was kind of making fun of it a bit just because I like to play with words. But a lot of times I use humor as a way to sort of diffuse the tensions because otherwise we'd be depressed all the time. I don't want to do that. And so as I'm rearranging my chair here, hang on. Ah, there we go. Okay. the legs of my chair are sometimes poked the wrong way and I have to rearrange stuff. But what's happening, and this is why it's so important, I think, that that you and I check, because we're from two different generations. In fact, there's like a generation or maybe even two generations between us. What that gives us both is incredibly different reference points. See, I remember a time when we had dictionaries and we didn't have computers. And so everything was written down. And we thought, well, this is so slow. You know, you got to look up words. You got to go to the library. You have to use the Dewey Decimal System. Do you even know what the Dewey Decimal System is? Did they ever talk about it in your history class? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I know the Dewey Decimal System.
Okay, good. So, but the point is that that's how we used to look stuff up, and we thought it was tedious and was slow, it was a pain. What we didn't realize then was that when the internet came about, you know, I love the internet. I mean, it's one of the greatest things because I actually got good answers to questions. I didn't have to rely on other people and their opinions. I could actually find what I thought was true and accurate information. What I didn't know about the internet, what we've only recently discovered, is anything that can be put on the internet can be taken off the internet. And so the beauty of books, those slow, tedious looking up of books that I thought was such a pain way back when, is now incredibly valuable because you can't repeal the book. If you got the book, you know, unless the government raids your house and burns books like the Nazis did in 1930 and other governments have done throughout history, you know, stealing your information, you know, they can't touch it. They can touch the internet, but they can't touch the books. So I'm after an 1800s dictionary because I want to know what words used to mean. One of the words that has changed is marriage. Marriage used to mean, and still does as far as I'm concerned, and millions of people across the world are concerned, billions of people actually, you know, marriage is a union between a man and a woman sanctioned by God and licensed by the state. Now, we can question whether we want that state license, but that's the definition of marriage. It's not a man and a man. It's not a woman and a woman. And it's not, you know, any other combination thereof. You can't marry the ocean as they did in California. You can't marry your pet. You can't do all this other stuff. So these definitions have changed because they don't want to keep the accepted definition of the word. What's another one? Male and female. Well, if you're a male and you think you're a female, that's okay. You can identify and change, you know, your identity. No, you can't. You know, so all these things, this is done. The best book on this is by George Orwell, who wrote 1984. And one of my favorite folks who I want to get on the show with you is Tina Terry. She's 75. She's an aerobics instructor. She's a carnivore, eats nothing but like steak. Fascinating one. Incredible history. Her parents were diplomats. She's lived all over the world. And she was an English teacher specializing in Orwell. And one of the things she talked about was the appendix. So if you're really busy with stuff, you can't read 1984, even though it's kind of short, read the back of it, the appendix, because it has something called Newspeak. That's N-E-W, New Speak. Have you read that? Go ahead.
I've read a lot of it. I don't know if I've read it completely through, but there's actually something funny with that. I had a cousin that I met out in Alabama, and they actually have two pigs. And they had a black one named Napoleon, and they had a white one named Snowball, and the white one died. And I just think
that's
a very funny.
That's Animal Farm.
Just like the story.
Yeah, that's Animal Farm, by the
way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's 1984 is a different one. That's also by Orwell. Yeah, that's another fascinating book, and that's where the expression, you know, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. In other words, you know, and you just translate that to people because it's a metaphor for people. But the way you were talking about here,
they change definitions too.
They do. Can you think of any? Think of any that particularly bother you in terms of change definitions?
Like in the story or in like real life?
Well, just in your everyday experience, like when you're talking, when you hear stuff on the news, you know, where, because I've got a bunch of examples. I actually was, I pulled them up on my phone and I've got a couple of them here I've written down, but I want to go to you first. What do you find some of the most offensive, let's use liberal talk for a minute here. What do you find some of the most offensive redefinitions as far as you're concerned?
The most offensive redefinition?
Well, in other words, if you take a word that used to mean one thing and now means something else, what anything particularly bother you? I've already named a couple. Marriage is a redefinition. Gender, you know, is a redefinition. I'll say another one that from an economic standpoint, inflation. Everybody thinks inflation is an increase in prices. It's not. It's an increase in the money supply. And the reason that they did that was to take the pressure off of people thinking that the government caused inflation when the government causes inflation. Government is the only cause of inflation because only government can control the money supply, the amount of dollars in circulation. The more dollars, the more inflated the currency is. That's what inflation is. And yet you'll hear all the time, they'll be announcing it later today, the consumer, you know, price index has gone up and inflation has gone up. No, it hasn't. Not at all. I'm going to show on this Friday, so I'm probably subject Amber to it. But that's a word that's changed. I'll tell you that, assault weapon. There's another good word that's changed. There's no such thing as an assault weapon. So I've renamed it a freedom rifle. So what you can do when words offend you and your sensibilities and your common definitions is you can redefine them back again or come up with a new term. That's why GOP, I made gelding old party. I'll let you look up gelding on your own. If you don't already know, I'm not going to explain it here. Okay. But I mean, but you see how effective that is? Language, the reason the left controls language is that allows them to control the debate. If they label Republicans as haters, and Republicans say, well, I'm not a hater. Well, they're using the same word hater. The minute you use the word that they use, you've lost. You've lost the argument because you're operating in their ballpark. So what you have to do is totally change the ballpark and change it completely. You know, and I mean, just, I don't know what you'd say to that. Republicans are haters. Really? Okay. In fact, I don't have anything right offhand. It's kind of unusual for me not to have an agreement offhand. But I'm thinking, go ahead, define it. What are you talking about? You know, and why is it that you can't stand freedom? Oh, there's a good response. Okay. Speaking of that, why is it that you hate freedom so much? Turn the argument around right on them just by the use of their own words. But the debate, the control of the argument is in the definitions of words, and that's why the left does it. And they control you by not letting you use your definitions because they say they're offended. Okay, so what? So you're offended. What, the world stops turning? Okay, if you're offended, that's your problem. It's not my problem. I'm not the one who's offended. You are. So you can use that too. I mean, all these things, yeah. So continue. This is fascinating.
And the thing that they're offended by isn't particularly the person saying things. It's they're offended by the truth that someone is speaking to them. Because they have a fear of the truth. Because they don't want to have to face it.
You are so brilliant. I can give you a round of applause. Hang on here. This is the where's my applause thing? I'll give you the gong first of all because there we go. And now where's my round of applause here? There we go. So next time someone says I'm offended, you say, "Oh, so you're offended by the truth, huh?" That's a great line. I'm gonna steal it. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And with that, Brad Stelling, he's like a really comedian. He was actually a speaker there. He was actually talking a bit about the war on language. So if anybody wants to go and look him up, I highly recommend. And something I heard, it was like a
I was gonna say go ahead. Yeah, I'm curious what you heard about this. Yeah.
Something that I heard, it was like a short clip of something. And I don't know who it was, but they are putting on this, like, slideshow presentation. And on one of the slides, they had up on the screen a red dot and a blue dot. And he was, like, asking the people, do you think these are the same size or something like that? And they looked the same size. Like, they were obviously looking the same exact size. And then he was telling the people, like, in the audience, well, they're not the same size. So he was asking them, which one is bigger, the blue one or the red one? And so you say, if you think the blue one's bigger, raise your hand. And if you think the red one's bigger, raise your hand. And then afterwards he said, well, it's wrong because they both are equal. And he was basically getting the point across that you have to trust your instincts, that he manipulated them so easily by just telling them that they're not equal when they could have obviously seen that both of the sizes of the circle were equal.
Mm-hmm.
They're both the same exact size.
And now you know how dictators operate.
So easily.
that's a microcosm of how dictators operate, you know, and they demonize, like Hitler demonized the Jews. They're evil. They're nasty. They're horrible people. And people who weren't Jews probably had friends who were Jews and probably went to Jewish shops and Jewish, you know, retailers and went to Jewish accountants and stockbrokers and Jewish, you know, jewelers and everything else. And they were perfectly fine with that. All of a sudden, Hitler says Jews are evil. And people who their previous friends, their neighbors, their family, you know, their cousins, everybody else that they came in contact with, all of a sudden they thought were evil. Well, Jews weren't evil. There's just a perception that changed. So you're absolutely right. So that's a microcosm. Which one's bigger, the red dot or the blue dot? So the power of suggestion is political psychology or psychological warfare, really. That's what propaganda is all about. That's how it works, the big lie. So you change the language, you change people's perception. You know, white supremacist. What's a white supremacist? I don't know. You know, And if there actually were white supremacists, how would they, you know, someone says you're a white supremacist. Well, how exactly do white supremacists exercise their supremacy? You know, how do they do that exactly? You know, because, and they say, well, because you're a right-wing white supremacist. Well, the real white supremacists were the Nazis. I hate to keep going back to them, but they're such a glaring and an easy example of everything that the world should never be again. They were the white supremacists, but they needed government to be white supremacists, right? So in other words, all the people they victimized and tortured and killed and everything else like that, all that happened because they were leftist white supremacists. So in other words, for white supremacy to flourish, it has to have a totalitarian government. But so if you believe in freedom and individual rights, you can't possibly be a white supremacist because you would never use government against other people. And yet that's the perception they're trying to get across. And the big lie that they also try to get across is that Hitler was a right-wing dictator, when actually he was a left-wing dictator. So you convince people that Hitler was a right-wing dictator, then you convince, you know, everybody who believes, you know, in freedom, you know, is actually right-wing when they're not. And all these reversals keep going on, but it's all control of the language. So once you establish that Hitler's a left-wing dictator and he's associated with the Democrats, you know, and the socialists and the Marxists, you know, now you've changed the whole argument around. But it all goes back to the red dot and the blue dot. I mean, you're absolutely right. And so the minute people had the suggestion in the head that one's bigger than the other, so let's go through that. So if you were in that same position and you heard that the red dot is bigger than that, one of the dots is bigger, what's your first reaction? What are you going to do?
I want a measuring tape.
Okay, yeah. So well, you're more scientific. Most people, I believe, are going to look and try and find which one is bigger. They're going to look at them very closely, right? And then they're going to do one of two things. What are they going to do next?
Make their decision on what they think is a bigger one.
Or there's another option. So it's only a suggestion
that they are still the same size?
Exactly. Exactly. See, I knew you're brilliant. So those are the two choices, okay? So the choices are to agree with the suggestion that one of them is bigger and then to determine which one is bigger, or reject the suggestion and say, no, they're both the same size. So let's divide up the crowd. So we've got those that say it's just the same size. They're done, right? There's nothing more. You can't tell those people anything. They've already decided that they're both the same size. So anything the speaker says after that is irrelevant because they're both the same size. So to decide what's bigger when you already know they're both the same size doesn't make any sense. That's irrational, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's call those people the non-mask wearers. You see where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
Okay. I literally just thought of that this second. I'd say ADHD is a wonderful thing. I hope you get some. It makes life very interesting. So the non-mask wearers decided, even though they were told that these masks, you know, stop COVID, which we all know they don't, because a big fat warning on the boxes from China, you know, said this does not prevent viral transmission. So anybody who read the box knows this didn't work. You know, but if you read the box and saw it didn't work, you still have a choice. You still have to wear. You can still wear it because you think it does work, even though the box says it doesn't. Or you say, "Well, wait a minute. I thought this was going to work, but I've just read that it doesn't work." So then you reject it. So the non-mask wearers are the thinkers. They're the ones who think for themselves. Those are the people that believe in freedom, reject government policy, and don't take a suggestion automatically. Well, let's take a look at the mask wearers. Let's take a look at the people that are looking at the red dot and the blue dot, and they're trying to decide which one's bigger. Why are they trying to decide which one's bigger?
Because someone told them that one was, and they just
So what is the need? Yeah, okay, follow it through. What is the need then? What is the person who thinks that one of them is bigger than the other? What is their need at that point? They've got the suggestion in their head. They're also in a crowd of people.
They don't
want
to have to think?
Partially.
Figure it out for themselves.
Okay, that's a big part of it too. Yeah, I think you're right.
It makes it easier.
Okay, but what else is going on? Remember, they're in a group of people. This isn't people being asked by themselves. This is a group. So think group psychology. What is going through their heads when the group is told that one dot is bigger than the other, and half the people have already said, "No, you guys are nuts. This is, you know." So they're not even listening at this point. They're on their Facebook. You know, they're already on their phones.
Yeah.
But half the group is looking.
They don't want to go against the herd.
Exactly. This is how you control people. So what is so even though there's a certain portion of those people that think one of them is bigger than the other, they can see that it's not. They can see that they're exactly the same size. But that's not what's going on here. What's going on here is the need to conform, to agree with everybody else, because they don't have the courage to stand out and say, you know, like the other half of the room, they don't have the courage to say those dots are the same size. So they have to conform, which means they have to go, as you said, against their initial instinct. They know the dots are the same size, and yet they're going to say that one of them is bigger. Make sense?
Yeah.
So what happens to those people? What's the next move? Once they decided. Go ahead.
They continue to keep conforming.
They conform. So now, what if the speaker says the red dot is bigger? Now what happens? They've already decided that one of them is bigger than the other. They've already gone against their instincts. So what are they thinking now?
They're probably going to argue that no, the blue one's bigger.
Some people will. Some people will, but most people who want to conform, we've already kicked out the leaders. We've already kicked out the smart people, the people that can think for themselves, the people that exercise and trust their own judgment. They've already decided the dots are the same size. They're not even listening right now. They're texting their friends. but the conformists, because they want to conform, are looking at the red dot now as bigger. And they're trying to rationalize in their head that the red dot is bigger, even though they know it's not bigger, because they don't want to stand out. They don't want to not conform. This is how it works. Okay? So now most of those people will probably believe that the red dot's bigger if you take a poll. Did that go on with your presenter? Did they get that far into this?
No, I don't think so. I don't know. I didn't see the whole thing.
All right. Well, let's explore it further, because this is fun. Now, here's the next question. If you were a power-hungry, mad, megalomaniac dictator, and you've already convinced half the room that one of the dots is bigger when clearly it isn't, what are you going to tell the half that believes a dot is bigger? What are you going to tell those people to tell the other half of the room that thinks they're the same size?
Whatever you want.
What would you tell them? You know what I would tell them? I would tell them to tell the other half of the room that they're wrong, that the red dot is bigger. They just can't see it. They're not experts. They're not following the science. They don't know. They need to conform. They are a threat. They need to put their mask on to save them from COVID.
Sounds familiar.
So if you're a megalomaniac dictator and you can convince, you know, whatever percentage of the population, apparently it only takes about 30%. If you can convince 30% of the population of one thing, you can turn them against the other 70% who are unorganized and the 30% who are organized under the dictatorship. You've got a totalitarian state. I think mask wearers were about 40%.
That's another thing that was on there.
Yeah. Okay.
Because if you convince enough people of one thing and you continue to do that, like generation after generation, age after age, then it becomes like a commonly known thing in society, even if it's completely untrue.
Brilliant.
Because you can easily manipulate some people. It's exactly what you're saying. Like, the more people you get to believe it, the more people you can manipulate that don't think for themselves. And that's why we need people who do want the truth and do want and don't want to just be fed the lies to conform, because it's such a smaller number.
So if you're the only person in a class and everybody else said 2 + 2 = 5, what would you say?
4.
Yeah. Now, can you stand up against an entire class and say you people are idiots? Stop being so stupid. It's not hard.
I mean,
it's not
easy
probably.
To
do. Yeah, okay. So I believe you could. And not just because, you know, I talked about it here on the show. I believe you could do that. But there was an experiment just like that. These experiments have been done, and you can probably look them up. I don't know the exact places or where, but that was the 2 + 2 = 5 experiment. So you have what people think are a normal class. They come in, they sit down. The teacher, you know, does math and says 2 + 2 = 5. Now everybody else in the class is in on it except one person, and the one person might say initially, "I think you made a mistake. 2 + 2 = 4." And of course, then the whole class stares at that person. And you hear what they said? 2 + 2 = 4. What an idiot. You know, they make all these insults. And the teacher says, what are you talking about? 2 + 2 = 5. It doesn't take long for that person to admit that 2 + 2 = 5, because the entire peer pressure is against them, and they would rather be wrong. They would rather believe something that they know is untrue than go against the group. And that is how you turn countries into dictatorships.
Yeah.
Mm. So those of us in the 2 plus 2 equals 4 club, regardless of what anybody else says, we're the ones who didn't take the COVID vaccine. We didn't wear the mask. We didn't accept Dr. Fascist. You know, we don't believe any of this nonsense. We think for ourselves. Now, I have a saying here at Action Radio called Assumptions are Stronger Than Truth. It's pretty much what you're saying. And you said it a lot better. And I'm gonna write this down. I'll check the podcast later. But the whole idea is that if you say a lie long enough, it becomes an assumption stronger than truth. People will go to the grave with their assumptions. A couple of them come off the head, off the top of my head right now. Have you heard that Supreme Court appointments are lifetime?
Yeah, I've heard of it, but I know that that's not out, actually.
Okay, so what's the truth?
Because I think we actually talked about this before, that it's
depending
on good behavior.
Good behavior, exactly.
Yeah.
So you know that. So even if someone said to you, well, the Supreme Court's a lifetime appointment, and people in Congress who should know better, they say it all the time. Well, you're up for a lifetime appointment. No, you're up for a term of good behavior, which is why no Supreme Court justice has ever been removed for bad behavior, because they think they're in there for lifetime appointments. Why would you even consider removing a Supreme Court justice if you know, in other words, assume, that they're in there for a lifetime appointment? Right?
Yeah.
So now they violated the Constitution. Everybody believes it. So groupthink. What's another good one? We're a democracy. I hear that all the time. We've got to save our democracy. Well,
we're not a democracy.
We're not a democracy. Exactly. Yeah. You know, another one that, like I say, oh, here's one, herd immunity. And if you remember, the definition of herd immunity was changed. Herd immunity, the old definition, the correct definition, the true definition, is when enough people are exposed to a disease and immune to it, that disease can't transfer because it keeps running up against people who are immune. So there's not enough, you know, vulnerable people to allow the virus to continue spreading or disease to continue spreading. So it stops. In other words, the herd has enough immunity that it stops. Well, the UN and the WHO, World Health Organization, changed that to say that only through vaccines can you have herd immunity so they can sell more vaccines. They literally changed the definition. Definitions are changing all the time. It's really scary.
It is.
What else? Anything else come to mind? Any terms you can think of that are unsure? Well, let's talk about this offended thing. So how important is it for people to not offend somebody else, and how is that used to control them, do you think?
I think it definitely is trying to be used against people.
Mm-hmm.
And wait, can you say your first one again, like the first question you said for this?
Oh, what, like inflation, herd immunity, which one are we talking about?
No, you said like two questions before I responded.
Oh, I don't remember. I'm sorry. let me ask you, here's a question I have thought of. If someone says they're offended to someone else, who's the victim, and who's the perpetrator?
I don't think that's a situation where there's a victim and a perpetrator.
Oh, I beg
to
differ.
I guess the person who says that they're offended would probably think that they are a victim.
Are they though? Why would you say you're offended? I mean, you might actually be generally offended, but that's not the context I'm talking about. I think in terms of control. If you say you're offended, who's being controlled?
The person who is speaking. Or
exactly.
Not the person who was offended. Yeah.
Yes. And this is how leftist Marxism works. So the reason people say they're offended is to control other people's speech. So that person now lives in fear. The person who said whatever it is they said, because they don't want to offend somebody else. They find that offending somebody else is some kind of a crime. And what we have to tell people is if someone else is offended, that's their problem. If someone else doesn't feel safe, well, they need to do something so they do feel safe. Well, that doesn't affect you or me. That's like when California judge, you know, said to people who wanted to carry firearms openly, well, you have to respect other people's need to feel safe. No, I don't. What they feel is their business. That has nothing to do with me and my rights. Rights are not superseded by feelings. If that were the case, we'd have a bill of feelings. We wouldn't have a bill of rights. The reason we have a bill of rights is so the government doesn't do something stupid like uses the excuse of somebody else's feelings to take our rights away. That judge was an idiot. You know, but that's how it works. So the left controls the debate by saying that they're offended, by playing the victim when they're really the perpetrator. and they are the perpetrator controlling other people. Because when they say, when someone says they're offended, that means that you have to conform. Well, how do you, let me ask you, how do you, if someone tells you that they're offended, what is the standard conforming that you think you're supposed to do? What do you feel? Someone says, just imagine someone said, oh, Brianna, I am offended. Now what? Gut instinct, what happens? What are you asking?
Yourself. The truth.
What are you asking? Well, see, I think the normal reaction is to say, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to offend. What did I do wrong? I must have done something wrong because this person's offended. Right? Is that an initial reaction? So what if you've done nothing wrong? That's how people are controlled,
yeah.
I think. Okay. So the initial reaction, I think if, you know, because this is, you know, if someone says to me, I'm offended, I should immediately think, what did I do wrong? What did I say wrong? And then I have to use my rational brain and say, I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't say anything wrong. Isn't there a problem? And then I come back with, gee, have a nice day. I'm sorry you're offended, but, you know, it's not my problem. I don't care. You know, I said, you should really deal with that. Have you sought therapy for your being offended all the time? I mean, you know, that's really a serious problem. How do you deal with being offended always? You know, and so just put it back on that. But no one says that. See the reaction. See, there's like a dance that you know they're the leaders and then the followers come in, and the followers are the people that say that, you know, listen to someone else telling them they're offended. It's really a fascinating topic. I can't believe we're almost out of time. We are out of time. How did that happen? I can't believe how fast this half hour goes. Well, we got Josie on. Let me play her thing. Do you have, we need to get you an hour. This is too quick. We're just getting going here. What do you think? Let me let you sum up for a bit. But this has been a fascinating discussion.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. Can you go forth braver and stronger and, you know, with these new tools in your mental toolkit and stand your ground and not assume that assumptions are true just because someone else says it?
It's actually funny that you use that metaphor, because that metaphor was used in Patriot Academy. They're fine tools for your toolbox.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, that's how I think of it. Like, I like to have prearranged things in my head because I'm not the fastest when it comes to when someone, because it's very disarming when someone says I'm offended. So I like to have things in my brain ready to go just in case. So that's kind of a personal problem, don't you think? You know, I like to have that kind of stuff ready because you look smarter and faster, you know, if you already have those things thought ahead of time. So think of things ahead of time. You should be okay. I'm going to play Josie's theme, but you're welcome to stick around if you have a few more minutes. If not, then this has been a great half hour. You have to come back next week, too. We'll play Josie's theme, and we'll get into the Lena report. She started off as a poor child in Nicaragua, living under communism. And now she is a prosperous small businesswoman with a great family, living the dream as an American citizen. Josie Cossey knows all about both worlds, communism and freedom. She knows where your dreams can come alive and where they can die very quickly. And so her report is as much from experience as knowledge, and her passion and crusade are very real. With connections all over Central and South America, Josie brings you the world south of the U.S. border from personal experience, living, not just reporting what's happening. And now, the Latina Report with Josie Cossey. And Brianna's still here, too, if you want to talk to her for a little bit. Good morning, Josie.
Good morning, Brianna. Good morning, Dobre Utra.
Dobre Utra.
Yeah, I was listening to you guys. It's kind of, good morning. It's, you're absolutely correct, Greg, about the dot, the red dot and the blue dot, and which is,
oh, that was Brianna's
which is
example.
Not.
Yeah, she was the one who brought that up. Yeah.
And what happens is in the communist world that I lived before, they want you to believe what they believe, not what you believe. They don't want you to think. Like this government here, they're trying to create all this, like you were saying before, white supremacists, racists, and all that. And people are not racist. People are marrying black to white to black. We're not racist at all. I mean, of course, there's a few people that might be radical, but that's, you know, the whole world is
not
perfect.
Well, that's a personal. There's a difference between a personal feeling and a government program. Affirmative action is a racist program, you know, brought about by the left. But individuals, if they, you know, if Asian folks hate, you know, African folks, you know, it's not going to change anything. There's their own personal prejudice.
Yeah, nothing
it's when it gets to the, it's when it gets to the government level that it becomes dangerous.
Yeah. Do you notice also all those radical fake news, they keep repeating the same exact thing, all of them at the same time, for you to believe it over and over
that point
and over
too.
So you can get it. And like when I go to Cuba on mission trips, they put the same movies over and over and over. They put the same programs over and over for people in Cuba to hate Israel over and over and over. So they're listening to the whole thing. They're being programmed. I don't know. They want you to hate Israel for some reason.
Gotta hate somebody.
You're in Cuba.
Yeah.
So it's part of communists. So it's pretty sad.
So what do you think of that, Brianna? That everything you're learning, you know, the left is using communist tactics, you know, to manipulate language, thought, and feelings.
And that's very true. Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you just fine.
Yes, you can hear.
That's exactly what's happening to the children in the United States.
All right.
Yeah. Oh, let's take Brianna and then back to Josie. Brianna, I know you had a comment, but
sure.
Just because you wait a second before you speak, which is fine, you can think, and I have to learn to give you that couple of seconds to think, but most people, when they hear like an empty space, jump right in. That's just kind of radio. So don't worry about it. That's just normal stuff. So Brianna, why don't you make your comment, then we'll go get back to Josie.
I was just saying that it was true.
Oh, that was easy. Okay, we got that established.
I actually got to go now, though, but thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks very much.
God bless.
Talk to you, Josie.
Bye-bye.
Bye. We'll talk to you next week. At least I hope so.
Bye.
Yeah.
That was
the fastest half hour. Well, we had such an intense time. And we got into political psychology. I don't know if you had a chance to listen to the whole half hour, but that was great fun. Anyway, let's go let you get to your report because Michael Volpe is going to come on at 8 o'clock and talk about wrongful conviction.
I'm
so,
listening to him.
Yep, that's going to be fun.
I've been watching a few videos on the death of the queen in many Latino countries. There's videos going viral of the hate against the queen.
Why?
The Latino people celebrating because she's a wicked witch. She's been for years and years and years. When the whole
thing
gets released, people get, well, that's your point, of course. But my opinion is when everything gets released, and there's a lot of videos of people coming forward, too, how she's been sacrificing and torture and kids in the basement, and it's true. It's been going on for years, including
in
the Vatican.
I don't believe that for a second. I think that's ridiculous. You know, what the queen did do was you know, she was there when about, I don't know, 30 or 40 different nations over the course of her reign got their independence, like British Honduras, which is now Belize.
Controlling.
You know, there's Jamaica. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of countries. That
in control.
I don't know if that might have been earlier than the Queen, but a bunch of places and territories, you know, they went from British protectorates or British territories to fully independent. Belize, we got Dallin Dawson from Belize. You know, I'll get him on the line. He can call in and tell us the story.
Well, the corruption is deep. It's been going on for a long time, but, you know, people just don't talk about it. People are afraid to come forward. I mean, there's a lot of people coming forward now.
That was the other option.
Huh?
Yeah. The other option is
or
the other the possibilities. Right. It's just not true. Yeah.
Well, we'll see what happens. But according to some people, which I don't know, I just saw it. I don't know if it's true or not.
Uh-huh.
Some people said that she's been dead since 2018, and they've been keeping her in the freezer. Mm. I don't know if that's true or not.
Josie, we got to start questioning your sources because there's some serious
it's some video.
Improbabilities
like I said,
here.
I don't know if that's true or not. I'm not saying
I don't think so.
That it's true. I'm just saying people are talking all kinds of stuff, you know.
Well, they do.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some idiot wanted reparations from the British crown for some imagined evil. You know, but the queen was a decent queen. Now, speaking as a Canadian Australian, I mean, I always rejected Britain as the authority over both Canada and Australia, and I wish they'd have declared complete independence and not have the governor general, who's the Queen's representative to Canada. The Queen actually had ultimate authority over Canada and Australia by law, treaty, and whatever. That's wrong. In fact, when the Queen, when King Charles was crowned king, you know, they said, we pledge our allegiance, you know, to rule over us as our sovereign. And I said, well, that's what we fought the revolution over. So, yeah. So this is why I reject monarchies. I like the idea of the British having a monarchy. It's fine for them. I couldn't stand one here, of course. But the idea of monarchy is kind of amusing. But it's not as evil, you know, and this is why they had the whole Magna Carta, you know, Oliver Cromwell, you know, beheaded Charles the First, which is kind of interesting. Now we have Charles the Third. But that was because the king thought, he believed in divine right of kings. The kings could do no wrong. And they had to stop that nonsense, you know. But the queen now, queen was a very stabilizing force, you know, in terms of, you know, continuity for Britain. And they like it. They like being subjects, though, and we don't. See, that's the difference between us and them.
Any government, any queen, king position is all corrupt, another type of government. And like I said, there's people celebrating in Argentina her death, some in Paraguay. They're excited about it.
These are Spanish countries. These are former Spanish colonies, the conquistadors, who went in and murdered and massacred all the Incas and Aztecs and native people.
I don't know. You know what I mean? So
well, do they or don't
either.
They? Let's get Pianki in the conversation. He's on the line, too. Pianki, why would people in Argentina hate the queen?
Oh, what a beautiful day.
Good morning, Pianki.
If someone say my name.
Not in vain, but yes, we did say your name. Yeah.
Yes, it's human beings or something else throughout the history of the life of human beings.
Well, what's your take on the queen, on the Queen of England, the monarchy?
Witch of the West to die?
Nah, she's not a wicked witch.
Oh, yeah.
I don't have any problem with her myself. It is what it is. That was good for some. And trying times for others. That's just the way things are.
Yeah, I mean, the peasants didn't show up with pitchforks and torches outside Buckingham Palace and said, you know, abdicate, abdicate, abdicate. You know, they didn't do that. The masses didn't revolt. You know, so she couldn't be that bad. And the British will do that, too. You know, things get bad enough.
Well,
and the British, they get...
They'll kill
you. Know, I've seen Monty Python. I know. Okay.
Mm-hmm. They'll kill you.
Well, they built hospitals.
Anyway.
They built railroads. They built roads. They built sewer systems. Agriculture systems and places where they were that probably would not had them at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the argument that the British, you know, they should have gotten out of India, but they left India in far better shape than when they got there in terms of roads, bridges, schools, churches, you know, sanitation, sewers, and everything else. So they got pretty decent infrastructure. But they didn't, you notice that the British in India did not, you know, stop the practice of Hindu. They did not destroy the Indian religion. And they could have made them all, you know, Christian, Church of England, Anglicans, and they didn't do that. You know, most
unlike the Muslims.
Unlike the Muslims and unlike the Europeans that came here to the Native Americans, they said, you can't believe in your gods, you got to believe in our God. If you don't, we're going to kill you. You know, the British didn't do that. I mean, they might have done it in the 1600s, and they certainly didn't treat us well in the 1700s, but by the 1800s, you know, things had changed. They're the ones that were the preeminent force to get rid of slavery in the world. Start with the British.
Yeah, they spent 100 years, 120 years working to get rid of slavery in Africa.
Mm-hmm. So, like most nations, they have their good points and bad points. They've screwed up. They've had colonies. They've had atrocities. They've had stupid wars and things like that. But they've also done a whole bunch of good stuff. Look at all our philosophers, all our politicians, all our founding fathers. You know, most of them are English and a few Germans scattered in there too. But for the most part, it's British.
But, you know,
white British men,
slavery.
You know, created this country. That's the way it works.
Greg,
what's
there's
that,
still a lot of slavery in Africa. There's still slavery in a lot of this country, how they sacrifice a lot of children.
Yeah, but it's not in Britain. It's not in British colonies.
World.
Yeah, but it's not in Britain or British colonies. So you can't blame the queen.
Yeah.
Where is it?
Yeah, I blame the queen.
Name a British colony that still has slavery. Name a British anything that still has slavery.
Well,
yeah, African Africa taught the world slavery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay. Well, back to the queen, though.
So a lot of people are celebrating. There's a lot of great videos, actually, and from Paraguay, a couple from Argentina,
mm-hmm.
and they're just talking a lot of stuff, you know.
What are they saying?
I don't have any evidence.
What's their primary source of joy that the queen is dead? What are they saying? What makes them happy?
Because there's people coming forward, like this woman at the age of three years old. She's describing everything that it was done to her, human sacrifice, and it goes on underneath. There was a picture a couple years ago. Let me tell you.
Yeah,
can you believe it or not? I don't care. There's a little boy, he must have looked like 7 or 8 years old, jumping from one of the windows. The picture went viral from the palace. So stuff like that has been going on for years and years and years. And then they're saying, this is not me, they're saying that Diana's coming back and Charles will not be king for long. Maybe for 3 months will be the most.
And Diana's going to come back. Let's mark the tape, as they say. So this is September 13th. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So it's saying 3 months now, December, October. So like a couple weeks before Christmas. Let's say before the new year.
Oh, after.
So Princess Diana.
They're saying in a few months when Diana. I'm just saying. I don't believe this.
Well,
you know.
Okay.
It's funny. They're saying when Diana comes back, King Charles will no longer be a king because he will be exposed together with all of them how they planned the death of Diana. So I was reading all that and watching a few videos of that.
You watch too many videos,
Josie.
These videos are infecting. You know, you're watching too many videos. This is an unreal situation. I'll tell you what is real though. That this was a huge problem that's still being, you know, what do they say? You know, shuffled under the rug. The kids. Remember when the Blitz was going on in London and the southern English countryside was being bombed by the Nazis in the Battle of Britain.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of families sent their kids away. They sent them up north. In fact, they sent some to Canada. I know because my mother, here's a story I've never told anybody. She grew up with one of the kids from England during the Blitz. They were staying with her family in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And they stayed friends for life. They were friends forever after that because they were childhood friends. But a lot of kids went to Canada. A lot of kids went to, Northern England, Scotland, you know, away from the bombing. And a lot of those kids were abused because they weren't with their families. You know, they were like worked to death and all kinds of other nasty stuff happened to them because they weren't with their families. So that's one of those huge scandals that really is still not being talked about. But the kids that were sent away from their families for protection were actually victimized by people that were supposed to take care of them until the bombing was over. Now that is very real. That's very documented.
Are you talking about 10 kids that disappear and they say that the queen took them?
No,
I'm talking
about World War II when the Germans switched from bombing the British airfields to destroy the Royal Air Force, the RAF, they switched to bombing London at night. Well, bombing is very random, especially in World War II. So you don't know where the bombs are going to drop. So a lot of parents were scared for their kids. They couldn't move because, you know, most people can't just pack up and go. But the British government sent the kids away. They sent the kids up north. They sent them to Canada. I think Australia is probably a bit far, but definitely the kids went to Canada. Because my family took in, you know, a couple of kids from the Battle of Britain. And happy to do it, too. You know, anyway. A lot of those kids were abused by the places that they went because they were strangers. They didn't care about the kids. You know, so the parents protect their kids, but a lot of these kids come back. A lot of those kids were scarred for life from their experience away from their parents during the war. Hold on, Pianki, do you have a point on that? You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, that's called a blitzkrieg.
Yep.
And that was the practice in many societies that was facing an enemy. They would usher the men, not the men, the women, well, the older men, but they would usher the women and children off into the forest, also somewhere into a cave in order to protect them.
Sure. Absolutely.
But Greg, there's so many videos, so many stories, so many people coming forward and all that. And a lot of it, I'm not surprised because look at our government here. Over 70,000 children per year vanish from the foster system in this country.
No, I believe
the
that.
The corruption is deep.
Yeah.
The corruption
there's
is so
a line.
Deep in our country. And so I can imagine what's been going on in Europe and with the Queen and with all these people. And mm-hmm. supposedly all the truth will be coming out. So I don't know because I don't have evidence. You know what I mean? But mm-hmm. There's some sources
we can speculate.
Talking about this human trafficker. And you know how they made that movie Hunger Game? This girl, she says at the age of 3, and she's in front of everybody with not far from the palace, screaming out loud everything that happened, and people are coming forward because they were scared to death before when she was alive, telling the truth. But I don't, like I said, I don't know. I'm just listening. And she's describing
every little thing. Be careful of what you want to believe. Hold on, let me express this here. Be careful
of
what.
I believe a lot of the stuff because
okay,
I know
wait a minute, hold
how
on. Right. Okay, but hold on. But there's a tendency to want to believe, and so people will take things in that they want to. Wait a minute. Hold on. Let me finish this one, because it's like climate change. People want to believe in climate change, even though the evidence is squarely against it. People want to believe that that Brandon is the president, even though we know there's massive vote fraud. People want to believe that the Queen was sacrificing babies in her basement. People wanted to believe that the Iraqis were throwing babies out of incubators. You know, people wanted to believe that there were weapons of mass destruction. That's why we went to war. People wanted to believe all kinds of things. People, you know, in Nazi Germany wanted to believe that the Jews were the source of all evil. Okay. So there's a line. Mm-hmm. There's a line between truth and fantasy. And the problem
is that
wait a minute, hold on.
But
hold on. I'm almost done.
Since
I'm almost done.
The corruption, how deep
right.
it is
but hold
here,
on.
And the human trafficking is so deep all
Josie,
over the
Josie, wait
world,
a minute.
It's like, I won't be surprised. You know what
okay.
I mean?
So let me finish my thought. Let me finish my thought here. That because people want, but everybody else gets to listen too. So what people want to believe determines a lot of what happens. It's like what we're talking about with Brianna. Assumptions are stronger than truth. People assume mm-hmm. that the Supreme Court can interpret the Constitution, but that's a bunch of BS. They can't do anything of the sort. Okay. People assume all kinds of things. They assume that climate change will kill us in 12 years. Well, that's ridiculous. Okay. They don't understand the carbon cycle. So there's a lot of things that people assume. So the problem with a lot of these videos and what you're getting, hold on, let me finish. The problem is that it distracts from the real work that we need to do. We have enough real problems. We have a tyranny in office. We have a coup that took over our government. We have plenty of things that are real. We do not need to manufacture things like the Queen sacrificing babies in her basement. That is not going to help us. It's not going to help us to talk about these. It's not going to help us to talk. I'll let you talk in just a minute. Trust me, I will. But it's not going to help us to talk about the sovereign state citizen when we're automatically sovereigns at birth. That's just a moneymaker for a bunch of corrupt individuals. Beware of the liars. Beware of the people that are preying on your emotions, that are taking what you say and what you think and what you want to believe. It's snake oil. They're coming up to you saying, yes, you can be a patriot. You can be a sovereign citizen. You don't have to pay taxes. You don't have to get a driver's license. Just sign here and give us $50. Okay? It's a bunch of nonsense, but it distracts from the reality.
Let me give you an example, too.
You see what I'm saying, though?
Yes.
Okay, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand, but there's a lot of truth and a lot of make you believe that it's true, but it's not. I understand all that. I've been around the block for a while. A lot of the stuff is happening, but the American people don't want to believe it. Let me give you an example. This lady that run away from the nurse, this facility, Kipling Manage or whatever it is, the place where they keep people mentally ill. And I called one of the ladies at my church because the lady appeared to come stumbling at my store, and she was there for a couple of hours. I was so busy. This happened months and months ago, of course. And this lady wanted to escape because the niece put her in there because she wanted to steal all her money, and she did, her house, her business, her credit cards, everything. And they put her there, and she had power of attorney of her grandmother. And this lady, her mind was there. She was speaking in German. She was telling everything to one of my German friends over the phone. I said, we need help. And, you know, as soon as I said, I need to take this lady to my church because the police is looking for her. I don't want to get in trouble. I don't know who this lady is. But she was crying. She said, I'd rather die than going back to that place they're trying to rape me, they're trying to do all this stuff. And I believe her because her mind was there. And as soon as I call one of the ladies from my church, she goes, oh, don't believe her because those people are mentally ill. And you know what? She's not mentally ill because one of the nurses came shopping into my store and she told me that that lady, she was in perfect health, perfect mentally, and her granddaughter locked her up in one of these places after COVID that she was so sick that she was supposed to come and take care of grandmother, and she ended up stealing everything on her behalf and took her credit card, house, and everything. And they all were in it. And that's what the nurse was telling me about it. And now, a very nice doctor, it happened to him because his wife wanted everything. And she locked him up, telling everybody that he's crazy in the head. And this lady was not crazy in the head. So as soon as I called my church about this lady, they called the police and they took her back. I was crying about this lady because they're abusing the police and the system with family members are abusing the older folks to take all their money away. And it's not a lie.
This I agree with you on. No, I agree with you on this because mental institutions have been used for, I don't know, as long as, probably a couple hundred years to be able to, husbands used to have their wives locked up rather than divorce them, say they're crazy.
Yeah.
This is before we had, equality under the law. And in fact, Michael's online. He could probably speak to this. I'll bring him on in a couple of minutes.
So this nurse.
But this kind of stuff happens. All right, let's kind of tie up this one because this is a special case. It's not going to apply to a lot of people unless they have people in there. But I tend to believe, that the folks, that have been locked in these mental institutions, if they aren't crazy when they go in, they will be because they're driven insane. It's like gaslighting. Gaslighting on an institutional scale. And that's not on purpose. So if you're too independent for your family, this is why I don't like families. Families have not been a good experience for me, that they will lock you up. Go ahead, Bianchi.
Go ahead, Bianchi.
They used to take white males and drive nails in their head to some doctors. It was experiments back in the day.
Oh, that was weird.
And, they used to take white males and inject them with malaria because of the temperature that your body responds from the malaria parasite. They was hoping that the thermal would cure something else. Nobody talks about
that. And Greg?
Yeah, go ahead.
And Greg, this lady, she's not allowed to talk to no family members. She's not allowed to have a phone or anything. So she has lost all her rights of everything that she owned in her life.
So did every COVID patient.
And I ended up talking.
Every COVID patient that couldn't see their family, that couldn't get ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, every COVID patient that was killed by the hospitals, to go along with the government protocols, it was more, it was legal to kill people. It was illegal to cure them. This is the most bizarre situation I've ever seen anywhere. It's a medical holocaust. And yet that's what happened. But that's groupthink. But you've got to stick to the reasonable and the rational and the things that make sense through your logic filter rather than go off on things that make absolutely no sense. And the reason that these no sense things are brought in is to confuse you, to distract you. It's like I know Ray Epps is an FBI operative.
I live through communists.
I can't prove it, but
exactly
I know
how people. Okay. I live through communists. I know exactly how they fool people, how they do that. But you have to investigate and go deeper. But right away, that lady from my church, she told me, "Oh, don't believe her because they're mentally ill." And I'm talking to the lady.
She's wrong. She's absolutely wrong. And mental illness is so subjective anyway, I think some of the most ill people are the people in the profession because they think they know everything. Look at electroshock therapy. How can you in good conscience give electric shocks to people and think you're doing good? You want to talk about warped? Let me play a couple things here.
Well, at the time they've done it, that's what they knew.
Yeah. Yeah, but someone has to reject it. Someone has to stand up and say this is wrong. Someone has to say 2 + 2 = 4. I don't care what you're all saying. Red pill, blue pill. Someone has to take the red pill and say, oh, this is the reality. You people are nuts.
During the time you had some doctors using electric shocks to treat people, and I tell you what, it does it today. You can buy these devices that you can connect to your USB port and pad and put your feet on, and it does tingle the nerves in your legs. And
oh, chiropractic
is an
electric shock to loosen your muscles, but that's a very low charge, and it's directed. I mean, electricity for medical has been used all the time. That's different than you know, giving you such a jolt to your brain that you go into convulsions and seizures. I'm sorry, I'm not a doctor, but I know that's wrong, okay? That's not the way to do it. Let me, Jesse, you want to sum up anything and get any contact information? Then I'm going to play a couple of things, and we'll get to Michael.
Well, Ruth Uniform Shops on Olive Road, and you can come and visit us. We are the news of the town there. Everybody comes and tell us everything that's going on in the hospital. So if you want to come and tell us what's going on, let us know. So we can report on
the Jersey Hospital Radio Report. Yeah, if you want to do extra reporting from the hospital, you know, the hospital stories, that's really kind of interesting stuff. I just found out, here's some breaking news for us. We actually, I just found out from the world map, we have listeners in the Solomon Islands. I mean, who knew?
I'm just
going over my little map, right? And I have my cursor just kind of going,
wow,
just looking for little
good
specks. You know, we're also in New Caledonia. So it may only be one person, but if it pings off the world map, then we find them. All right, let me play a couple things. We'll get
cool
to Michael, and there you go.
Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Penglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com.
Do you know your way around healthcare, insurance, pharmacies, surgery, alternative treatments and choices? I don't. Which is why I'm so glad I met Priscilla Romans, had her on Action Radio, and learned about health patient advocacy. She is the founder of Grace Care. And now as an affiliate of Grace Care, we are proud to offer through our discount code, WYL, which stands for Write Your Laws, a 10% discount. Grace Care saves you both time and money. They provide medical advocacy, consultation, advice, and recommendations nationwide. Their website is gracecare.com. That's GRAITHcare.com. You can email them at gracecare.adm@gmail.com or call them at 469-864-7149. That's 469-864-7149. Grace Care, better health through better knowledge and advocacy.
Radio, dedicated to fixing everything.
And my apologies to Josie for cutting her off there. I didn't mean to. I was hoping to play the ad that has a 5-second delay, and I was hoping to time it right, but I screwed up. So sorry, Josie. Michael Volpe, welcome back to Action Radio. You have an interesting topic for us today, so feel free, launch into it, or if you want to comment on anything that we've been talking about so far, you know, you can drop into that stuff as well. How you doing, dude? What's going on?
I'm doing pretty well. I have some experience with people being put into psych wards as a means of retaliation, abuse, and otherwise. First of all, the actress Frances Farmer, they forced a lobotomy on her. She was an actress, I think, in like the 50s and 60s. They made a movie about it.
Who's this name?
Just completely.
What was the name?
Frances Farmer was her name. She was at one time kind of a big deal actress. They made a forced lobotomy and just destroyed her life because she was eccentric. Go figure, an actress who's eccentric.
Exactly.
Probably the most.
Hell, I'm eccentric.
Right. Right. Probably the most notorious case worldwide was a doctor named Ignaz Semmelweis, who now today is credited with finding the cure for childbed fever, which was actually forcing doctors to wash their hands after doing procedures. What was happening was doctors were doing autopsies and then they'd go and deliver a baby without washing their hands, and that would create germs. And he insisted that doctors needed to wash their hands, and doctors didn't want to wash their hands. And eventually a bunch of his friends threw him into a psych ward and he died there. And a few years after he died, Louis Pasteur came up with his germ theory, which built on what Semmelweis was arguing and proved it. But he was dead by then, and he died in a psych ward. Did an article about a guy named Jim Murtaugh, who was a whistleblower at Emory University, and they did involuntarily commit him to a psych ward. Eric Gluck, who was a Navy whistleblower, they tried to involuntarily commit him. Uh-huh. It happens. It definitely happens to whistleblowers. Semmelweis is considered like a hero to global whistleblowers. I don't remember which country, but he practiced medicine in Europe in the 1800s. But now he's considered the man who solved childbed fever. Then he's basically this crazy man who had to be locked up in a psych ward, and his wife went along with it. His friends and his wife were the people who
had following the science. They're following the science, Michael.
Right. They were. What's just crazy is that it was all because doctors just virulently did not want to constantly wash their hands, and he couldn't quite prove it until Pasteur came up with germ theory, because he was like, you know, the stuff you leave on your hands is bad, and they're like, no, it's not bad, and it was germs. And until Pasteur came along, no one could describe it scientifically, and that was basically the missing link. And you know, the really unfortunate thing was Pasteur was working on his stuff for a while, and the two research, if they had come together, it would have resolved things a lot quicker. But Pasteur wasn't aware of what Semmelweis was preaching, because it probably would have helped him.
The main point that's really incredible that you're making is that if you go against the grain, if you go against the convention, if you have a different opinion, you know, like Galileo and Newton and other folks who are excommunicated, you know, during the Inquisition, they bring you at stake simply for having a different opinion. So a different opinion or a new thought or a new idea is so dangerous to vast numbers of people that they're willing to kill you for it. You know, you look at anybody who expresses, look at people who say that Trump won the election. You know, it's not as bad as it was in different times, but there are people who would love to see those people locked up and put in mental institutions. That would include me, you know, simply for having a different opinion, even though I'm pretty sure I can prove it, you know, based on everything I have. But you can't go against.
Right. And that's
the population.
That's exactly what happened to Semmelweis. You know, Semmelweis didn't do himself any favors, because he was obsessed with arguing, and he would, like, people who mostly agreed with him, he would pick fights over the things they didn't agree with, and that may have actually been his PTSD. I wrote a book, and he's a chapter. It's called The Definitive Dossier of PTSD and Whistleblowers, and I talked about how he had this obsessive need to argue with everyone, including people who weren't even necessarily dismissing his argument. Everyone was wrong. This is the key. He was right. Childbed fever was caused strictly and singularly by doctors who would do autopsies and other things and then not wash their hands and then reach into a woman's private parts and grab the baby. And as a result of that, the woman would get germs. It was 100% because of that. And some doctors would argue, well, it's probably this, but could also be this. And it wasn't the second. It was only the first. And he just had this obsessive need to argue with everyone, even the people who were largely agreeing with him. And he wasn't strategic, but you're right. They did excommunicate him. And before they threw him into a psych ward, they got him fired. They got him blackballed. They did everything they could. And in a sense, it was kind of like that with Jim Murtaugh. He was terminated from Emory University, and he discovered grant fraud. It was a slightly different thing, but I don't remember if they did put him in those psych ward or they tried, but they definitely at least attempted to. Francis Farmer, just a really horrible story. I don't think that could happen now, but...
Well, things are different. There's more video, you know, things are being captured that we never saw before. This stuff was snuck in, and of course the news could doctor the stories. But it's interesting. When you wrote that book, did you come across doctors that just out of curiosity washed their hands just to see if it helped? I mean, was a certain portion of doctors who were scientific inquiry said, well, I can wash my hands. Let's see what happens.
He had a following. He, you know, at some point it wasn't just him, but very small. That, you know, Jim Murtaugh, he studied Semmelweis because he's a whistleblower. Semmelweis is considered a whistleblower. And, you know, he told me even today, doctors don't like to wash their hands. It's just it's like this reflex, but, and
that's
he called
funny.
It conscientious washing. He, you know, you can't just, you know, throw some soap on in 2 seconds and put your hands under water. You know, it's got to be very, very, like, deep and long and get everything and everything, because, and it's the germs. And again, that's what he was missing, was that it was germs. He knew that something was causing it. He knew that it was because you weren't washing your hands, but because he couldn't prove that it was germs, they could dismiss him. But, you know, it's completely bogus. I don't know. Like if Pasteur had come up with germ theory, they, you know, you can move the goalposts a million different ways. But he was thrown into a psych ward, died just a horrible death there, like 2-3 weeks after he's thrown in there alone.
Wow.
Miserable.
Well, yeah,
because
he went against the grain.
Death.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, too. Yeah. This is a little different subject, but they found that Civil War soldiers, the ones that drank coffee, lived longer and were healthier than those that drank water, fresh water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they didn't make the connection. They said, well, these soldiers, the coffee guys are doing fine, so I want you all to drink coffee. Okay, great. What they didn't realize was that it wasn't the coffee, it was the boiling of the water that they took out of the rivers and the streams and things like that. They got rid of the amoebas and the parasites and everything else. And so it became a thing, but they actually looked at it and said, okay, well, I guess we're healthier drinking coffee, better drink coffee. And I don't know when they made the connection, but it was boiling boiled the water and then drank it. By making coffee, they inadvertently discovered that they were healthier and they weren't dying of parasites and amoebas. Pianki, you had a quick point?
They learned that from, Chinese is working on the Transcontinental Railroad too. How they prepared their food and herbs that they use, that they were suffering from some of the sicknesses and diseases that the Americans were, the other workers.
Did they cook food differently, or what did they do? What kind of herbs? I'm just wondering. Were they American herbs,
the
local stuff?
Particularly the boiling of water to make tea.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah, same thing. Tea, coffee. So in other words, the world was healthier, not because of it is healthy because of tea and coffee, but it's also healthier because you're boiling the water. I love these little inadvertent discoveries. It's quite fascinating. Michael, we should get back to your main topic, but it's an interesting lead-in that people who are wrongly convicted, you know, of being mentally ill and thrown in a mental hospital is very similar to being wrongly convicted and sitting in jail for 50 years when you didn't do it.
Right, but before that, can we do like 10, 15 minutes on the transgender issue invading family court? I think we got time for everything.
Yep.
So I have since probably June. So first of all, there's the most notorious case and the case that if you follow it that everyone knows of the transgender issue in family court is the Younger case. It's out of Texas.
Yep.
It's where the mom started calling the boy, not James, Luna, I think she started calling her. And they've not done anything like chemical or biological, meaning she just dresses him as a girl and calls him Luna and treats him like a girl, but she hasn't castrated anything or anything like that. But
good. you know, she should be.
Right.
They have to stop that. They can't let that happen to this poor boy.
Well,
they haven't
done that.
Go ahead. What's the father doing?
They haven't done that yet. And the father, of course, is saying, that's crazy. The boy is a boy. Stop this nonsense. But the courts are catering to her and actually siding with her And she has physical custody. She has sole custody. They do have joint decision-making, and they did put into the court order that she cannot do any of the surgery without the father's approval.
Well, that's
but,
good. So, what if she does it secretly?
Right, I saw...
You know, what if she doesn't...
Well, that would...
I hate this case.
She'd commit a crime.
Yeah.
Right. She'd commit a crime. The one thing that is of interest that I'll relate to in these other cases is they have appointed to that case, I think, a guardian ad litem, a parenting coordinator, a couple of therapists. It's just this laundry list of court actors who are now appointed to the case to try to figure it out. And then dad's lawyer, and dad, remember, is the one not trying to advocate transition, called it high conflict. And that's basically the scam. And that is how I think they're going to treat all of these cases, and they are coming.
Who's the transgender? Because the boy is, and the boy knows he's a boy. The father knows he's a boy. The mother's a whack job. You know, is she some kind of feminist that hates men or something? She wants to take it out on her kid. I mean, what's going on here?
I don't know what the boy thinks. The way the mother described it is. My son at 3 told me that he wanted to pretend to be a girl, and at 5 he said he wanted to stop pretending. And she said, well, then I guess he's a girl. And this is the kind of quackery that this – and who I believe is a doctor herself, not of this thing, but she believes is a doctor herself.
Okay.
Right. Just craziness. But the court is catering to it, but the scam is if there's this – transgender issue where one parent wants to transition them and the other parent doesn't, the court will immediately call it high conflict, and that will be the excuse to bring in parenting coordinator, guardian ad litem, a couple of therapists, this, that, and the other.
It's the
and
money.
Scam people.
It's the money.
And to create money.
Right.
So
this is awarding the this goes along with your theory, and actually I believe you absolutely, that they award the kid to the most disgusting, most horrible, most abusive parent to continue the conflict, forcing the good parent to fight forever to get their kids back. And I know several stories. I'm not going to names here, but they've been on the show.
Then,
go ahead.
Right, and then all of it becomes an excuse to call it number one high conflict. That becomes the buzzword, and high conflict is the reason why we need parenting coordinator, guardian ad litem, two therapists, an evaluator, this, that, and the other. Correct. That's absolutely
but transgender
right.
Is a mental – it's a personal mental health issue.
They will
it's
never,
not real.
The courts will never say that. They will never say that. They will never treat the parent who's trying to do that as a whack job, and they will never say that because you are trying to transition your child or because you refuse to accept the gender of your child, that in and of itself makes you the unfit parent. So I happened to, by accident, out of Kane County, Illinois, that's the same county where Carol Witkowski's son was murdered by his father, who continues to roam free because no one wants to do their job.
Right.
I was actually
been on the show
for a different –
She
has been on the show and many other shows, and still the murderer continues to roam free. Everyone knows what happened, and they're continuing to allow this. But in that same county, and I was actually listening for another case, this case comes up, and I put it up on YouTube. You can find it. And so
what's
all I
channel?
Know about this case is from what, the,
what's your channel, Michael?
Michael Volpe is my is the channel. But
okay.
So all I know about this case is the 20 to 30 minutes that I'm listening to this one hearing, but it was absolutely fascinating. The guardian ad litem jumps in and starts talking about how he's confused because the two therapists on the case are disagreeing with each other, and then just very nonchalantly says, and then the gender issue. And then as you go along, you find out that there are two kids, a boy and a girl, and each of them wants to be the other sex. And everyone is blaming the other. The dad is saying that's crazy. Neither of them should switch sexes. And then dad's lawyer, remember, dad is the one saying we need to stop this nonsense. Dad's lawyer is explaining dad's case. And then at some point during his presentation, the lawyer says, and that's why I think we need a custody evaluator to – quote unquote, tie it in a bow. So there you go. It's high conflict. We have a guardian ad litem. We know we have a guardian ad litem. We heard from him first. We know that the guardian ad litem is confused about what's happening because he said he's confused. We know that there are at least two therapists on the case. And what is the answer from Dad's lawyer? Let's bring in one more person. And that's how they're going to do it. That's the scam. You saw it. Prototype. Mm-hmm. The other case is a little bit different. It's out of California. A guy named Mikhail Bendian and his ex-girlfriend, Kristen Haynes. And when I say guy, what I actually mean is a woman pretending to be a guy.
Say a woman.
He says he's a...
You know, it's like the person, our Surgeon General, is a man who wears a blonde wig.
I know.
You know, Michael Thomas is a swimmer swimming in a woman's swimsuit on the women's swim team at UPenn, but he's Michael.
Right.
You know, my solution is put the team in bikinis, but that's a different story. Go ahead.
He identifies as a man. Obviously he's not the biological dad. There's a question as to whether or not he's actually the dad, since he's not actually
a man.
Are we
talking about a real he or a real she? Is it a he or a she that we're talking about?
A real she with a prosthetic penis. A real she with a prosthetic penis. Now, number one, Kristen did go out with him at one time, and she also put his name on the birth certificate as the father. So he does have legal rights to the girl.
That was stupid.
But until March of 2022, Kara is actually Mikhail's first name. Kara Mikhail Bendian had non-custodial visitation rights. The daughter, who was 13, I believe she still is 13, visited him. And then he says, I'm not bringing her back because she now realizes that mom has been alienating her from me and she hates mom and she won't go back. And the court, and the judge's name is Roger Chan over in San Francisco County, allowed it. There was a court order that said when each parent is supposed to have the child was supposed to go back to Kristen. Child did not go back to Kristen, and Roger Chan allowed it. Set off a chain of events. What happened? Roger Chan immediately, well, maybe not quite immediately, but within a couple of months, appoints a reunification therapist. There's already a minor's counsel.
You know.
Right.
You
know, yeah.
Let me just jump in for a second here, because we've got a theory here that I've been working on with some people. I'm not going to mention names yet, but we have some folks that are victims of family court, and we came up with the idea because legislation's too slow; it's not going to get anywhere. But some of the victims of family court, I said, well, why don't you become judges? And so this is something I want. If you can tell me how we can do this, because most cases in the state, I'm not going to mention the state, I'm not going to do anything to identify these folks yet, but some of the states I've looked at, you don't have to be a judge or even a lawyer. You don't have to have any legal training at all. You just have to be elected. You know, so you can elect a judge, you know, with, you know, just like you can be on the Supreme Court and not have even been to law school. Okay, so there's a lot of people. This might be a whole new avenue to explore if you can look into it, because this is your ballpark. You're good at this. How people can become judges.
That they tried. One woman tried that in New York. She ran against the judge, who Franchetti is her name, who granted sole custody to her ex, and then Kira is her daughter. Kira was killed by her ex. She ran. She got crushed. I just want to read. Mikhail yesterday sent me an email because I do want to comment on one thing.
Yeah. Okay.
I have asked you not to email me. I am asking again, do you not email me or my family? Again, I'm so confused. Aren't you against reunification therapy? I am, Mikhail. I think it's complete garbage. I think it's complete garbage in this case. What needs to happen in this case is the court order that's in place should have been followed. You should not have been allowed to just keep your daughter, so to speak, who's not actually your daughter. You're not actually her father, all right, because you're a woman, not an actual man. You're pretending to be a man. And you should be following the court order that's supposedly in place. And I watched a hearing yesterday, and Kristen begged the judge to switch the custody arrangement so she could get custody time during vacations. He gets custody time during vacations. He's supposed to only get her on Thanksgiving, Christmas, and whatever other vacation time the girl has. And she begged the judge to switch. And so the next time she's going to see her daughter is Thanksgiving. And he protested like the guy was sending his daughter into a war zone. And this is how arrogant the guy is, the woman is, because she knows that the court is catering to them. I don't even know what to call him or her, but
well, whatever they are biologically, you know, whatever their chromosomes
right,
say
yeah,
is
well,
who they are.
Then she, you know, and Kristen has to beg to switch custody so she at least gets non-custodial visitation rights. And here's what he said. This is setting up for failure here. Can we not start with something like, I cannot even, hold on, I cannot even get her on the phone. Why do I feel like this is going in the wrong direction? It's not in the support of their daughter. This is what he said about allowing Kristen to see her daughter for 4 days over Thanksgiving. And he's claiming that she was alienated from him. He's treating like 4 days over Thanksgiving is sending his daughter into a war zone. This is why I can't stand parental alienation. All right? I don't understand. If suddenly the if the girl went from being in the physical custody of her mom to hating her mom, who in the world, which of these two parents is being alienated? All right? He's using parental alienation as a weapon. This mm-hmm. guy is just the lowest of the low. He's not her father because he's not a he. He wound up on the birth certificate. He barely took care of this girl.
How do you
he
get the birth certificate? How do you put a woman as father on the birth certificate? Why would she do that?
Come on.
Just a mistake.
Because they were at the time in a relationship, and she, you know, he's not, obviously he's not the biological father because he's not a biological man. But I haven't asked Kristen that. You know, you can't go back. That was 13 years ago, but that's okay. What gave him custodial rights. But you know, his girlfriend, who's a lesbian, you know, she's a lesbian. So I don't understand. She's with a,
Wait a minute, if you're a woman, a biological woman in a relationship with another woman, but if you're pretending to be a man, you're still a lesbian.
Right. Well, then there you go. That's what, that is what the tale is.
You know, we got to do the truth here.
Yeah.
And
Greg, do you think that might be a little confusing for a 13-year-old?
Well, of course it's confusing.
Do you think that might be it?
It's confusing enough when you know, kids have enough trouble in this world, you know, to figure out who they are
uh-huh.
without having to think uh-huh. about the woman who's saying that she's, you know, her mm-hmm. father. I mean, that's cruel.
Right.
That should be abuse in itself. Mm-hmm. But parental alienation,
right.
you know, we used to think of, this is before we started, but we used to think of parental alienation is where one parent, you know, badmouths the other parent in front of the kid. And
mm-hmm.
you know, parents
mm-hmm.
who are divorcing have a tendency, or divorced parents have a tendency to do that. That's not what's going on today, folks. Today it's a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Volpe says it's a weapon
right.
that's used by
right.
the alienating
you
parent
know.
To alienate the other parent by accusing them of being alienating. It's like when someone says, I'm offended,
right.
they're the perpetrator. They're trying to shut the other person up.
Right.
That's how it works. Yeah, go ahead.
Right, and I would say that bad-mouthing the other parent is bad-mouthing the other parent as opposed to parental alienation. Just
mm-hmm.
just to describe the behavior as it is as opposed to using some buzzword or label.
Yeah.
And so that
mm-hmm.
that's really, look, there's a guy who I wrote about, Dr. Luigi DiRuba, and you can find his article, and he's convinced that he was alienated. And I talked to him and I said, look, if it's a layman's term, I don't care. Even if it's a psychological term, I don't care. But then you bring it into court, this nebulous term that can be misused a million different ways, and that's the problem. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, his kids suddenly hated him and refused to have anything to do with him. And, yeah, you know, I don't know what parental alienation is, so I don't know if he's being alienated. But something bad is happening to him. I agree. But
it may not be a legal thing. If it's happening, should it be raised to the level of a legal argument, strategy, or problem? In other words, if one parent's, you know, bad-mouthing the other parent to the point of, you know, you don't want to have parental alienation as a legal category, it may be just a problem. And there's a lot of things that we know are problems. You know, it's like parents who are late on picking up their kids or late dropping them off. That's just abuse. But that, we don't raise that to the level of a crime or a thing in court, you know, punishable by law. And I think the same thing with this whole idea of alienation is the same thing. Yeah, it's a problem. You deal with it individually. It's not a situation. And it might go to divorces and custody and all kinds of other things. But you don't raise it to the level of its own category, parental alienation, and then create a whole bunch of law around it. Same thing with transgender. Transgender is a personal mental issue. It's not a civil right. And the problem is that we've raised
mm-hmm.
it to a civil right. And so people think that they have, of course, think, well, it's a civil right. We have to honor it because, you know, we, you know, transgender is a category. No, it's not. It's a mental issue. It's something that someone has gender dysphoria. They are confused about the gender. That's fine. You can be confused. You can get help for it, or you can stay confused. Either way, it's your choice. But what you can't do is victimize other people because you're confused. Because you're confused about your sex,
and
with the one you were born with.
Right.
You cannot then take that and use it in court against somebody else. That's where I draw the line.
Correct.
Well,
And of course, Judge Roger Chan would never say, listen, you seem to be confused about your own gender. We can't have a girl be raised in that environment. So
that would be grounds, I think. If someone's that confused about it, that might be grounds for limited visitation or, you know, have the other parent be primary custody. Pianchi had a comment. We got Pianchi and Josie listening on the line too here. So Pianchi, you want to get in here on this conversation? Feel free.
Well, you're right. There is some mental issues going on here, but the most important thing, you should keep these people away from kids because that's the energy that they suck on and even to go forward in the future. Because if it wasn't for the kids, they would just disappear. They can't have kids. So they always want somebody else's kids. That's how they thrive.
You know,
that's
kids never worry about the gender either.
Thrive.
I've never seen a kid worrying about his gender or her gender. They know they're boys and girls. They don't worry about it. It's the parents.
They don't unless
the
they're encouraged to.
Yeah.
That's where it comes in. Someone, some adult that has that deviation encouraged a child to take on that type of ideology. Therefore, if you want to call it a movement, it continues on in the future. But you keep the children away from them.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to the wrongful convictions.
Okay.
All right, so I got a whole bunch of them that we can talk about, and so we got about a half hour. We'll just go through as many as I get through. So one that I have
What's
been
a
covering
conviction?
A lot is a guy.
Let's define what these
wrongful
are.
Wrongful conviction
right.
is someone who is convicted of a crime and they didn't do it. And you had Jeff Deskowitz on your case. He's an exonerated, wrongfully convicted individual.
No, he's done a couple times.
Convicted of murder.
Yeah, I forgot to let him know you were on today. Jeffrey Deskovic has his own foundation. And so he was convicted of murder at the age of 16, I think. And he served 17 years in prison, or he convicted of 17, he served 16 years, whatever it was. He served damn near 20 years of his life for something he didn't do. And it changed your whole life. You never escape that. You know, so now he has a foundation. Yeah. It's like the Innocence Project. And I firmly support both Jeff and the Innocence Project.
As do I, and he was convicted through a false confession. False confession is one of a variety of techniques or ways in which people are wrongfully convicted. One thing that Jeff told me, which is interesting, is that eyewitness testimony is the weakest form of testimony, that eyewitnesses are often wrong, and so, of course, jurors usually have no idea about that, so they hear that an eyewitness identified someone and think that's really strong testimony, and in fact, it is not. So the first case that I wanted to talk about is a guy named Randall Rahr, and he was convicted of several things. One is possession of child pornography. He swears that's a nudist colony magazine, but let's put that to the side because he would long be out of jail by now if it was just possession of child pornography. He was also convicted of child sexual abuse. And this is the more important part of his conviction. The child was allegedly 5 years old. Her name is Heather, but she didn't testify until she was 21. In fact, when she was 5 years old, according to therapist's note, she fingered a guy named Jimmy who was her babysitter. Only at 21, after they discovered this nudist colony magazine, did police canvass the area, and did Heather, now 21, say, yeah, Randall molested me when I was 5 years old. Obviously, she was the only evidence, and somehow a 21-year-old testifying about things that happened when she was five led that jury to believe that that was guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. He'll probably die in jail unless something happens. A few other things that are interesting about his case is that he was working for a newspaper and was investigating a string of serial killings that happened in 1976 and 1977. He was doing some FOIA requests, and within 2 months of those FOIA requests, the cops showed up. He told me when they first showed up at his house, they wanted to know what he knew about those murders. He said that he believes law enforcement was the killer. Those are unsolved. You can look those up. Those are
notorious. Oh, law enforcement killings. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Well, see, this is a common tactic. We've seen this with Democrats a lot of times accuse Republicans of sexual scandals as a political thing. Donald Trump had any number of women come forward and say, oh, he abused me, you know, way back when. And, of course, after the election, they disappear. Our own Congressman Matt Gaetz had this. Jim Jordan's had this. Roy Moore in Alabama, who's been completely exonerated of everything. They've all been proven to be false allegations. But that's not the point. The point is you upset the voters before the election. So this is false accusations are huge. Mm-hmm. That's how red flag laws operate a lot of times. You know, someone, you know, one spouse doesn't want the other spouse having guns. Usually the woman doesn't want the guy having the guns. You know, so she says, well, he's crazy. You can't let him have his guns. So the guns get taken away and she's happy because she's, you know, punished him. You know, men will do the same thing to women for whatever reason, things that, you know, say, well, you can't let her do whatever X, you know. And so these things happen out there. Well, she's crazy. You better lock her up in a mental institution. You know, so the laws are used horribly against other people. But it starts with a false accusation. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Right. I don't know if it was false. I wasn't there.
Okay.
The troubling part about this case is that under no circumstances should a 21-year-old testifying about things that happened when she was 5 be anywhere near guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. This is what we need to examine about the case. How did it get to be that this 21-year-old testifies to things that happened when she was 5, and a jury of 12 people goes into that room and says, well, that's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well,
that's not anywhere
near. The judge
near.
Said, it depends on the judge's instructions. Yeah. It depends on the competency of the defense attorney to cross-examine that witness. I mean, there's a lot of variables here.
It does depend on that, and the stuff with Jimmy didn't come out at trial. Randall told me he didn't even know about it until after trial.
That's
obviously
exculpatory. Yeah. So prosecutorial misconduct of the withholding of exculpatory,
in other words,
that'll get them out of jail. Go ahead. What?
Not necessarily, because I don't know if that was because the prosecutor withheld it or because his defense attorney didn't use it.
These are the variables. So the variables are prosecutorial misconduct, withholding evidence, incompetent defense, a judge issuing bad instructions, you know, a stupid jury. You know, so your life is in the hands of a lot of many variables.
Listen,
yeah.
I don't care what the instructions were, and as incompetent as his lawyer probably was, the bottom line is that you heard a 21-year-old testify to things that supposedly happened when she was 5. There's no other evidence, because there can't be, and you thought that was enough as a jury, 12 people. It's on the jury. That's horrific.
Yep.
It goes against the entire
principle should have said something.
Of our justice system.
Yeah.
Right. Did you all look at that and say that's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt? You didn't think that the fact that she was 5 when this happened and she's 21 when she's testifying in and of itself mean
well,
that
variable
it's reasonable
too.
Doubt?
There's another variable. It was a 5-year-old girl. Nobody wants to see a 5-year-old girl victimized. And so a woman comes forward and accuses a guy. It carries a lot more weight than a 5-year-old boy who says, well, at 21, well, this woman abused me when I was 5 years old. They're going to see the guy. Yeah.
That's not dealing with the evidence. Then again,
that's
the jury.
There is a tendency to believe women, you know, more than men in court. And you know that's true. Look at the rate of conviction. Women get treated differently in criminal court than men do. Men have a much higher conviction rate. They have a higher arrest rate. They have they have longer jail sentences, and all for the same crimes. That's been proven. That's documented.
I don't know if that's true, but I do know I do believe that juries are more likely to convict on serious crimes as well. But I don't know. The bottom line is when you go into that jury room, you need to, and this may seem like a distinction without a difference, but your job is to examine the evidence and determine whether the prosecution met its burden of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. What is reasonable doubt? That's up to you to figure out what is reasonable in terms of doubt. But it's outrageous that that a 21-year-old can testify about things that happened when she was five.
Well, look at,
and
look at the Kavanaugh hearings.
That was,
just to bring up, because you made this point here, but look at the Kavanaugh hearings. You had Dr. Blasey Ford, you know, in her, what, 50s or 60s, talking about, you know, the that Brett Kavanaugh somehow allegedly abused her in high school. You know, she doesn't know where, she doesn't know when, she doesn't know anything else. And yet half the nation went, Brett Kavanaugh, you know, he's an abuser. Give me a break.
Right. That's not a criminal trial. All right. Everyone knows.
The perceptions are the same. The perceptions are the same.
Right,
everybody thought he was guilty.
Everyone knows.
Because the sweet little old lady
did.
Was there, you know, and big back Kavanaugh.
Right. Everyone knows that O.J. did it, but the prosecution didn't meet its burden. So in my opinion, the jury got it absolutely right. That jury did the
that's
right
a great
thing
question.
In the O.J.
No, that's actually – let me talk – stop there for a second because you've raised a fascinating point. Should a jury, knowing that O.J. did it, but the prosecution failed – to prove it at all, and they have huge reasonable doubts, should they find, you know, not guilty because the prosecution failed to meet their burden, even if they know he's guilty, because they can't know. But that's a great question. Go ahead.
Of course. The job of the prosecution is to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The problem with juries, I believe, is far too often they go back. And I wrote a book about a guy named Chuck Panici. It's called Prosecutors Gone Wild. And I didn't talk to any of the jurors, but I firmly believe this is what happened. They go into the jury room and they start to say, did he or she do it? That's not your job. And it seems like it's a distinction without a difference, but it's not. Figure out if the prosecution met its burden of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury, in my opinion, absolutely did the right thing in the O.J. trial. The lead detective had to plead the fifth. All right? That is reasonable doubt without everything else. It doesn't matter what the evidence is because the lead detective had to plead the fifth. So you as a juror can no longer trust that any of the evidence was acquired fairly. All right? O.J. could afford lawyers that could create reasonable doubt. That's what happens when you're a football star and you have millions and millions of dollars. Randall Rahr could not. The other people that we're going to talk about, they could not. That's the unfairness of the system. But in my opinion, and you know, the opinion is not
what's the race
only
of
one way. But in my
what's his race?
He's white, but I can talk about a few black guys who got screwed as well. Look, let's talk about another guy, Robert Reynolds.
Sure. Mm-hmm. All right. Oh, another
three
guy. What a surprise!
Right.
Sorry.
Right.
Go ahead.
Three people were caught in a room with drugs. Those three people, in order to get lighter sentences, said that Robert Reynolds was their dealer. Robert Reynolds was convicted on the strength of three people testifying against him. No physical evidence.
Who were all facing charges, right? They were all facing drug charges, too, right?
Reduced sentences to testify against him.
Yeah.
Once again, I want to understand how a jury could go back into the jury room, hear from three people who got deals and be provided with no other evidence that he did it and think that's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. If someone this is what happened in Chuck. Hold on. This is what happened to Chuck Panici in my book. He got convicted of a bunch of bribery schemes because three people, all of whom got deals, a guy named Nick LeBoux, Ralph Galderian was the third guy whose name I can't remember, all of them got deals to testify against him. That's it. They didn't find any gold. They didn't find any bonds. They didn't find any money. He got all kinds of money, gold, and bonds, and somehow none of it could be traced to him. But three people claimed that they either gave or received gold, bonds, and money from or to Chuck, and that was enough for 12 people to convict him. He spent 8.5 years in jail. If you are on a jury, in my opinion, if you are on a jury and you are hearing someone testify, and during that testimony, he says or she that I am testifying as part of a plea deal, then you should dismiss that testimony out of hand because that is a form of bribery. You
was that
not
disclosed
accept,
to the jury? Was that disclosed?
Disclosed.
Okay. Right, that's fine.
It's always, you know what, I don't know if it was disclosed. It definitely was disclosed. I can tell you, it definitely was disclosed in Chuck's case. His lawyers did not do a good job, but they definitely made sure that
so the
jury
knew
that
the jury knew that that this was part of a plea deal, that they were testifying as part of a plea deal, and they were going to get a lesser charge for saying basically what the prosecutors wanted. Okay, now here's where I think the problem is. In these cases, the instructions of the judge, I think the judges, in issuing their instructions, I think this is a huge failing in the court system, they basically tell the jury how to rule on the case based on their instructions. You know, and one of the biggest problems, and this is why we have a bill to fix this, that the judge says you can't judge the laws. And this is a little bit different, you know, than what you're talking about. But he says you can't judge the laws. You can only judge the facts of the case. You can only judge this. And here's the criteria that you should use to decide this case. So they basically instruct the jury. So the first thing we need to do is stop the judges from instructing the jury. Just say, here's the case.
Mm-hmm.
It's yours. Go into the jury room. Come up with a verdict. Mm-hmm. And that's it. That's your instruction. Go to the jury room and come up with a verdict. Yeah. When the case is over, when the final arguments have been made, that's it. You don't instruct the jury. That's prejudicial right there. Have you looked into that at all, the judicial instructions, or have you reviewed the instructions themselves in these cases of wrongful convictions? I bet you find a huge part of the problem is in the judge's instructions. Betcha.
I don't know if I've looked at that specific issue, but in general, one problem is the prosecutor's office is a much greater farm system for judges than is criminal defense attorneys. And so many criminal defense attorneys will say
so they're predisposed to be prosecutors. Yeah, okay.
Right, but that a judge acts more as a second prosecutor than they do as an umpire.
So like Chris Wallace in the Trump debate. Well, here's a question for you too then. We know that prosecutors, they rise in their career by the number of convictions, even if those convictions are wrong. Do judges rise in their career at all by presiding over convictions? Is there any incentive for judges that's totally out of the blue, but I'm just wondering. Is there any incentive for judges to have more prosecutions under their belt than acquittals?
I'm not sure if that's true, but I think they have a natural.
No, I don't know if it's true either. I'm just wondering if that exists.
But
at
I think
all.
Most
saying,
of these,
yeah.
I think okay. too many of these judges have a natural siding with the prosecutor because many of them were prosecutors. They weren't criminal defense attorneys.
Are they more willing to overlook prosecutorial misconduct then? Are they more willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the prosecutors? Okay, gotcha.
Correct. Now, so let's talk about what you just said with another case where prosecutors rise based on convictions, whether they are faulty or not.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about this, but many years ago, so we'll talk about it again. John Juca, you had his mom on with me, Doreen Giuliano. He was convicted. He's called the Grid Kid Killer. And
what's that come from?
He was prosecuted.
What's that name come from, so people understand?
I don't remember how they came up with that, but he was convicted of killing this college kid. The prosecutor who prosecuted him is a woman named Anna Siga Nicolazzi, and she currently has a TV show on ID called True Conviction.
How
and
convenient.
She was in 21 years as a prosecutor, 35-0. And what we're learning now is of those 35,
wait,
many
she had 35
were
cases
done,
in 21 years?
Yeah, but she won all of them.
But I understand
that's
not many cases.
So,
I guess each case takes what, like 6 to 8 months? Okay.
Well, no, that's about right. Yeah, three cases per year. It's not that. No. That went to trial. She probably had a lot of cases. She probably had a lot of cases that were plea bargains. Correct. Mm. So he was called the Grid Kid Killer. He's convicted of killing a college student named Mark Fisher. He was convicted of felony murder. Because four people claimed he'd confessed to encouraging directing the shooter, Anthony Russo. And there were several things that are very, very corrupt about this trial. The first is that the jury foreman was desperate to get on the jury and wanted John convicted, number one, because he thought he was Jewish, because his last name is Juca. Even though John Juca, G-I-U-C-A, is not actually Jewish. Also,
that's
he knew
Eastern European.
John. I don't know if they...
what's that?
It's Italian. But
oh,
Doreen
Italian. Okay.
Went undercover.
Yeah.
Doreen went undercover. Doreen secretly recorded this guy And this guy boasted about how he got on the jury, how he wanted John convicted. She took those recordings, presented – her lawyer presented them to the judge, and the judge admonished her for going rogue and doing this operation on her own and refused to overturn the conviction, even though there was clear juror misconduct.
Well, how did he get on the jury anyway? Didn't the defense attorney challenge, or was this guy such a good liar
He didn't mention you think he said, "Oh, by the way, I hate John Jucco because he's
No, but I mean, was there anything in his past? Did they ever have a past conflict? Did they have a high school fight?
No,
I'm just curious.
I think it was it was like friends of friends. I don't know if they knew each other directly, but indirectly they did know each other. He lied about his relationship, which happens not all the time, but it happens. I am friends with a guy named Fletcher Long, who defended the main guy from Vanderbilt rape trial. Vandenberg was the guy's name. And after Brandon and the rest of his defendants were convicted, he found out that, again, I don't know if it was a jury foreman, but again, one of the members of the jury had previously been sexually assaulted and withheld that information. And obviously, if you've been previously sexually assaulted and it's a rape case, you cannot be on the jury. And that's how they got the original conviction dismissed. And Vandenberg was then convicted in a second trial. But juror misconduct happens. You know, most people don't want to be on the jury. Some people are desperate to be on the jury for their own reasons.
Misconduct. Let's define that. I've always understood it, but I've never had a name put on it. So how would you define juror misconduct?
It's lying during voir dire. Misrepresenting.
Voir dire is when you're in jury selection.
Is when, correct. There's a famous scene, and that's voir dire as well. In My Cousin Vinny, talk about the car, but that's. Voir dire happens when they ask each person on the jury, is there any reason why you could be why you would be biased? Have you served? You know, I've served on two juries, and it's like a standard series of questions like, have you served on a jury? Is there a reason that you might be biased? You know,
are you
whatever
a radio talk
else.
Show host? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Are you right? So it's so he lied, and so did this person in the Vandenberg trial, and it happened. And Fletcher told me that as a criminal defense attorney, that was something that he had to be aware of and had to account for, and basically that in order to win criminal trials, you had to overcome what you expect to be juror misconduct. Another form of juror misconduct is accepting a bribe. That generally happens with gangsters like John Gotti and Al Capone. It doesn't generally happen in regular cases. Most regular people have no idea or resources to even figure out who's on the
but
jury, let alone bribe them.
And a bribe doesn't have to be money. A bribe can be a position, can be power, can be access. It can be all kinds of different things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, interesting.
Right.
Okay.
In Capone, in Gotti's case, it was just money. And it's not only those two, but it's generally gangsters because regular people don't have the resources to corrupt a jury.
Regular people don't need to. Regular people don't commit crimes when they need
to. Right. And look, Gotti, that's how he
got off. But false accusations.
You know,
how are you defending against a false accusation?
And what's crazy about bribing a juror is and he wasn't it's gangsters. The only cases I know of where juries are bribed, there was a gangster who did it. But what's crazy, like in Gotti's case, the crime of jury is called, I think, jury tampering, is like a year or two. So he was able to get himself off of murder charges, and then later on they found out about the juror tampering. Well, that's like a year. So you already got off of the key crime, and so they can go after you for the jury tampering. I think he was eventually convicted among
so
much
instead of 20 to life, he got a year.
No, yeah, well, he was also convicted of murder. He was convicted of murder as well eventually.
Okay,
but
and
he
jury
was
tampering.
He was a right. He was the, he was so it's worth it because even if you're caught, that's a year. But the charges you're actually charged with are much more serious. And,
well,
perjury is
7 years. Why is perjury seven years and jury tampering is one? That doesn't make any sense.
I don't know.
I don't either. I'm just asking
the question. It's a huge problem with the law, but getting back to Juca's case, one by one, each of the four people who testified against him started to recant. And then most recently, in 2018, and he was convicted in 2005, the defense discovered that there's an audio recording of Nicolazzi interviewing an informant named John Ingram, who told her that in jail he met both with Russo and with Juca, which would not happen by accident because those two would be separated. So that most likely means this guy is like a professional informant, so to speak, that he was placed into the prisons to make sure he could talk to both of them. And he told her that Juca said he didn't do it and that Russo admitted to him that Juca didn't do it. This was withheld from the defense. The defense discovered it in 2018. We are in 2022, and they are still awaiting a ruling on whether or not the withholding of this evidence should lead to a new trial.
Yeah.
And so on top of everything else.
Well, I was just saying, we have about 5 minutes left here. Or we can go a little bit longer. And I've got some. Apparently, we have overtime at Blog Talk. But what do people do about this? What are the ways, you know, what are the remedies? What are the ways that for if someone has a wrongful conviction, what can friends and family do to fix that? What are some of the common methods?
Well, in this case, everyone needs to contact ID and ask them why they allow this woman on the air. She has show on ID. You need in the Juca case.
Yeah,
we
got Judge
Jeannie. Judge Jeannie. Right. No, listen, in Juca's case, you need to leverage ID. It's absolutely shameful that they continue to allow her to have a show. All right? This is a corrupt prosecutor who used her corruption to steal convictions and then leverage that into a cushy job as a TV host. And ID knows it. All right? I'm not the only one who knows about the Juca case. They
is
all
that
know.
The network? ID?
Investigation Discovery. Investigation Discovery. You can reach out to them. Reach out to them and ask them why you allow Anna Siga Nicolazzi to continue to have a TV show when she's a corrupt prosecutor, when she clearly leveraged her fame by being corrupt into a spot on your network. Why do you allow her to continue to have a show? The problem is that it is so difficult to get these overturned, even when you have the media on your side. There's a case, Rodney Reed, you know, he's championed by everyone, Oprah, Kim Kardashian, you name it. The evidence is clear that he didn't do it. He still remains on death row. 20-some years, everyone knows that he didn't do it, and they just refuse to overturn it, and that's received an enormous amount of attention.
That's a problem too. That there's a refusal by the system is that they don't want to admit a mistake, they don't want their record tarnished. I mean, it's all selfish. Between the judges and the prosecutors, what is the resistance when they know? And everybody knows. In a particular case, these people are innocent. There's still resistance to let them out. What's that all about?
You remember Dan Rather and the thing he did with George W. Bush and the Vietnam record and how he got that wrong.
Mm-hmm. Not all the details, but
I
just remember, Kenneth, what's the frequency?
Right. If you're a prosecutor and you are involved in a wrongful conviction in which case you have committed malfeasance, the damage to your career is as significant as the damage to Dan Rather's career. So the resistance is that keeping that person in jail, you're fighting for your own life then. Because if you are labeled with malfeasance and a wrongful conviction, it's not something you can recover from. And not to mention, and Jeff made tens of millions, the amount of money that the wrongfully convicted will get, the threat to the office, the threat to everything. Yeah, no, there's reverberations. If John Juca, if and when John Juca is deemed innocent, then there's at least 35 convictions that you have to look at. You know, do you want to let out 35? I don't know if all 35 were done through cheating.
Well,
how many
tens of thousands of people are in prison letting out 35? You know, what is it? Is it job security at stake or something? You know, it seems to me that there is a reluctance to let innocent people go just because, you know, well, they're already there. You know, it's like, well, we got to maintain the system. We got a couple minutes left. Let's talk about DNA for a little bit here. What role has DNA, and I'm going to get Jeffrey back. I got to get him back on the show. It's been too long. But how has DNA changed everything in terms of wrongful convictions?
It's changed a lot, but not every case has DNA, but
okay.
The ones that do, you know, DNA is tricky too, though. Fletcher did a case, the Wooded Rapist, and this guy was convicted strictly on DNA evidence, nothing else. Nothing else. This guy was found by no one, identified by no one, seen by no one, but he left his DNA. Does that seem suspicious?
Well, yeah, because then you get planting DNA. So the good side of DNA is it can exonerate somebody. The bad side is if someone takes your DNA and, you know, however they get it, you know, a cup in a restaurant or something like that, you know, they can put it anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So DNA is, it's not secure.
Fletcher believes that at least in some of that, it was the Wooded Rapist. So obviously it wasn't just one rape, but he believes that at least in some of them, that's what happened. That they felt that this guy did it, so they'll just plant his DNA. But he
to make convictions easier. Oh, that's interesting.
Easy. DNA is, you know, it's the same thing. You know, like if your DNA is at the scene, then 100% you're guilty.
Right.
Nothing else. All they had was DNA. It is kind of it's really interesting that they got a conviction and. It's just DNA, nothing else. So he's smart enough to avoid detection, avoid eyewitnesses, avoid – no one sees his car. No one sees him there.
But he wasn't wearing
trace
gloves.
Of him.
And he sneezed on the wall. Right, okay, fine.
Everything but he left DNA.
Mm-hmm.
How is that? I don't know that. It's like the master criminal who made one fatal error. And maybe he did. They did find his DNA. So, you know – none of this is 100% foolproof, but DNA has exonerated a lot of people. And what the Innocent Project found is that 1 in 4 wrongful convictions that are overturned using DNA was based on faulty eyewitness testimony, which goes to, again, that eyewitness testimony is the weakest form of testimony.
But that's why we have cross-examination, though. The whole point of, in fact, you look at the Constitution, you look at our Bill of Rights, I think, four of the amendments are dedicated to accusations and false accusations and just the whole criminal process. Let's go through this real quickly because I bet you you got a couple extra minutes? This might be interesting.
Please. Yeah.
Yeah. So the First Amendment is free speech, free religion. Second Amendment is guns. Third Amendment is no soldier shall be quartered in your house. That one doesn't seem to apply too much, but it's nice to have it. Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. And I want to add the word arms to that someday. So it's persons, houses, arms, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. Do you know the old definition of what unreasonable means? Did you ever look it up? Because I did. So it's kind of a loaded question.
What does it mean?
Unreasonable. Today we think of a reasonable search as something, I have a good faith belief this is happening. If you look up the definition of unreasonable in the 1700s, it means without a warrant. In other words, you had no reason to do it because you had no warrant. So it really should read against unwarranted searches searches without a warrant. And then it says, shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So if you take out the word unreasonable and you put against, you know, searches without a warrant, well, it changes everything. But that's what unreasonable meant, which is kind of interesting, especially applied today. Fifth Amendment, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless upon presenting an indictment of a grand jury. So I guess all these people had to go through a grand jury before their trial. So cases on, you know, first the military, times of war. Okay, so during declaration of war, it's different. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy, that's double jeopardy clause, of life and limb, or shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. That's what they call taking the fifth, nor deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, due process clause, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Well, that's eminent domain, and I think it sucks. But anyway, you got two amendments out of ten. The Sixth Amendment. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right of a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed. So there's more rights of the accused, okay? So then you got, you know, and the Seventh Amendment. In suits in common law, this is the civil court, you know, in value exceeding $20. Well, it's stupid they put a value on it. They should have known the value was going to change. Amendment 8. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishment. So Amendments 4 through 8 are all in the rights of the accused. Well, that's half the Bill of Rights. It's actually more than half. Right. That's incredible.
As it should be, because before you are deemed an official suspect, and certainly before you are jailed, you should enjoy a series of rights to make sure that everything is done fairly. And I could be wrong.
Well, not fairly. It's done by
due
process. But they recognize that the government, the biggest effect on people, the biggest power that the government has is incarceration, the denial of all freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And the founders recognize that because the British were horrible. I mean, they didn't have they had general warrants. They would go fishing. They'd round up people. They'd arrest people. That, you know, the trial would be in Britain and they'd hang you here. I mean, the founders realized that one of the biggest abuses of government is the criminal justice system.
Right.
But that's really,
and,
that's
and
significant.
I believe
people,
before you can get a warrant, I think the standard is probable cause, whatever that means. But
that's a good question.
No,
what does it mean? So probable means there's different levels of I forgot what it's called. But probable cause, reasonable suspicion is the lowest level. Okay. So in other words, when I was my brief career of federal law enforcement, the standard at the border is reasonable suspicion. Probable cause is a much higher standard. You know, so reasonable means, I think you might have done it. So you're talking less than 50%. Yeah, I got a reasonable suspicion. You know, not even a reasonable proof, but a reasonable suspicion. So now we're talking like below 50%. Probable cause is above 50%. You probably did it. Okay, we're not 100% sure you did it, but you probably did it. Okay, so now you're looking at 80-90%. You know, probability that person did it. That's a pretty high standard. So probable cause is a much higher standard than reasonable suspicion. And I'm not a lawyer. This is where we need Jonathan, you know, to find out what the other levels are. But I believe those are the two main ones. Reasonable suspicion. In other words, I think you can pull somebody over for reasonable suspicion, but if you're going to search their car, you need probable cause. So a taillight out, that's reasonable suspicion. Yeah, you got a problem with your car. So we're going to pull you over because we think you might, you know, we just want to pull you over until your taillight's out. Now they smell marijuana. Well, now they got probable cause. Okay. So you see how it elevates. But this is so important for people to understand in the system, that the criminal justice system, that there are six rights. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Five rights. I can't count. Half the Bill of Rights is dedicated to the rights of the accused. That, to me, is fascinating. Let's see if Pianchi has a comment.
Okay.
He's been patiently waiting, too. And then I'll let you go. And then I'll talk about the pesky Trump electors that won't give the deep state their coup, which is the title of the show today. No, if you want to hang around for that, you can, too. Depends on my time. Pianchi, do you have any comment on this so far? No, I'll go back to Michael.
No, I don't.
Okay. Michael?
All right. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Comments, books, contact information, websites, Facebook
pages.
Yeah. Don't get away without that.
Yeah. If you want to find my work, go to michaelvolpe.substack.com and you can sign up for subscriptions, free and paid. If you sign up for the free subscription, every time I put a post up, you get it in your email. But more than half of my posts are behind the paywall. So if you want to read everything, it's $5.99 a month. So check that out. MichaelVolpe.substack.com. Four books. The one most related to this is Prosecutors Gone Wild, The Trial of Chuck Panucci, Louise Marshall, and John Gliottoni. And if you want to see how a prosecution manufactures a case against all three people, that's the book to read. All three of them were innocent. The other two were tried because they really wanted to get Chuck, who was a big deal at the time. He was a powerful mayor. and committeemen and could get the votes out unlike any other. And people made their careers by prosecuting him falsely. So check that out. And that's basically it. And my most recent article is about that transgender case that I mentioned, Mikhail Bennion. And he and I went back and forth a little bit. He doesn't like me very much. I don't give him any reason, but I read a little of his emails. You can check out the entire thing. And you'll see, you know, I've run across people like him a lot, and I compare him to other people like him who I've run across. It's a personality type. People who thrive in court have a certain personality type, and you'll see the other examples of people who act the way he does. So check all that out. Michael Volpe, substack.com.
See, you would have forgotten all that if I hadn't asked you. I wonder if we would have made good defense attorneys. Michael, do you think we would have made, if we'd been to law school, do you think we would have made some decent defense attorneys? I think I would have. I think you probably would have too.
I would rather get burned at the stake than be a lawyer, so I don't know.
Okay, that's fair enough. Yeah, it's a bit late for law school for me. Cause I'd rather write the laws that lawyers have to defend in court. All right, sir, thank you very much. We'll do it again soon. Take care. And with that, I'm going to play a couple things, and I'll be back with more. Here at Action Radio, we are looking for sponsors. We have 30 and 60-second spots available for your announcements, and we have 3-minute live call-ins to talk about your products and services available. Action Radio is the next evolution beyond talk radio. Join us and let us help your business evolve. Think about being a sponsor of the future and not just a listener, and help us help your business grow as you help us plunge headlong into breaking new ground here on Action Radio every day. This is Greg Penglis for Strikeforce, your source for pure energy. Strikeforce is a concentrated energy drink that turns a half liter of your favorite beverage into an energy drink. You make your energy drink yourself. Action Radio is an affiliate of Strikeforce, so our listeners get a 20% discount. All you do is add our code, WYL, to the discount code window at checkout. WYL comes from our website, Write Your Laws. So, you can get your energy drink, a 20% discount, and help Action Radio change the relationship of we the people to our government. Not bad. Strikeforce is at StrikeforceEnergy.com. That's StrikeforceEnergy.com. Start your engine. From addiction to achievement, that is the story of Mike Lindell. It started with MyPillow and now goes to MyCoffee. Action Radio is proud to be an affiliate of MyPillow. Our discount code is the same for all our product affiliates, WYL, which stands for Write Your Laws. MyPillow pillows are guaranteed the most comfortable pillow you'll ever own. Action Radio is guaranteed to be the most controversial show you will ever hear. Check out their products with our discount code at mypillow.com/WYL. That's mypillow.com/WYL. Or order now by calling 1-800-544-8939. That's 1-800-544-8939. Sleep well, so you can wake up and hear Action Radio live. Joe Biden's dark winter. No freedom, no liberty, no guns, no representation, no oil, no coal, no nuclear power, no space force, no constitution, no family gatherings, no vacations. Just taxes, work, misery, masks, lockdowns, and ever more government. This is what will happen if you let Marxists steal the election. This has been a public service announcement of Action Radio, reminding you it's time to get off your butt
and save your country. Action Radio, part of the ADHD Radio Network, the ultimate free speech zone. We the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed, and have the power through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. At Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news. Every other show reports what has happened. We talk about what can happen. From the questions no one has thought to ask, to the answers no one has thought to consider, to the actions no one has dared to take. That is Action Radio.
Here we go again. Yes, let's take an exploration into that brave new world where timid folks are fearful of treading. I've got Bianca on the line, and anybody else wants to join us, 215-383-3832. That's the number that you're looking at right on your broadcast page, which is why I don't give it very often, because it's right there in front of you. So something's going on, and I noticed this last night with a story I heard about Stephen Miller. So you know me, I get curious, and I want to know the whys, the wherefores, I want to know the details, and I like to go beyond, you know, what's being reported, and to sort of, you know, try and figure out what's really happening. It usually takes a few articles to do that, in which case, let me see, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 for this particular topic. 6 articles that all kind of came together and have made a picture for me. Now, the title of the show today, in case you're wondering, you know, why I picked it, those pesky Trump electors won't give the deep state their coup. There's a lot of meaning and significance behind that. So the deep state is terrified of the Trump electors. What are the Trump electors? Well, those are the electors that the state legislatures of 7 battleground states put forward, as well as the Democrat Biden fraud electors. And so we've got 7 states with 2 sets of electors. Okay. Now, the states that had only had them put forward by the legislatures, those are the ones that should have been counted, but they weren't. See, in all 7 of these states, they counted the Brandon electors, which is fraud, which is unconstitutional, which is illegal. Because when states put 2 sets of electors forward, first of all, you have to see where they come from. If they come from the governor, they're not valid, because only the state legislatures can do that. It's in the Constitution, in Article 2, Section 2, I believe. We've quoted this a bunch of times. So let me pull it out once again, Article 2, Section 2. No, it's Article 2, Section, where is it? Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors, Article 2, Section 1. Now, Article 2 governs the executive. So this governs the election of the president. So the state legislatures control the election. The state legislatures appoint. It doesn't say elect. It says appoint. Well, the state, you know, the electors. Well, that's how they do it. Now, they can take a popular vote. They can do all kinds of things. But the point is that they appointed 7 battleground states, appointed Trump electors. Well, they also appointed Brandon electors. Well, now we got a problem. So how did Mike Pence resolve that? Well, he simply denied the Trump electors, declared a coup, you know, and put Brandon in office. That's what the whole January 6th was about. That's why they had the Trump supporters upstairs, so they could twist arms downstairs to make sure that the Brandon electors were taken over the Trump electors, even though there was massive vote fraud with the Brandon electors, and that's why it's a coup. Now, most Americans, you know, they may know Trump was elected. They may think Trump was elected. You know, they may think Brandon was elected. They may know, and even though it's not true. But they, as far as they're concerned, they know that Brandon was elected. They think this is all over. They think it's done. I mean, they don't like Brandon. The policies suck. He's running the country to the ground. But they sort of accepted the coup. I haven't. Now, there is a group out there that has not, that is still worried, though. Even though they're in the White House illegally, even though they control the government illegally, even though they're an idiocracy, you know, I think the new rule is, and I put this on Facebook the other day, that nobody can be smarter than Joe Biden and serve in the current administration illegally. You know, and you look at all the people, Jean-Pierre, what's her name? Karim Jean-Pierre, Karim Abdul-Jabbar Jean-Pierre, whatever her name is an idiot. You know, you look at most of the people in the State Department. Ned, what's his name? It looks like one of the characters in the Star Wars, the original Star Wars, bar scene. He looks like one of the band players or one of the customers. Weird looking guy. You know, the Secretary of State, the Defense Secretary. None of these people have any intelligence whatsoever. Look at the border czar, the CHP head, Mayorkas. What a total moron. So we're being run by an idiocracy. So nobody can be intelligent in this administration of idiots at all. So, and they do that because the people that are really in charge don't want any opposition. They don't want any conflict. They want the idiots out there out front so they can do all the bad stuff behind the scenes. But they are still worried. And why would they be worried? Why would they be worried about Trump electors when everybody's declared Brandon electors to be the valid ones? Because they know it's not true. That's why. And this is where it gets interesting. They know it's not true. What's the January 6th committee for? This is all settled and done. Settled laws, as the Supreme Court justices would say, you know, when they're lying to you. Well, this is settled law. No, it's not. And they know it's not. But they say it anyway because that's what their law school and their judgeships told them to say, right? So they're just following orders, right? So if you're a deep state person, if you know you stole the election, if you're paranoid that everybody else is going to know that you stole the election, you have to keep lying to the public to make sure they don't think about how you stole the election. Okay. Well, those of us out here who listen to Action Radio and a bunch of other shows and things who actually know what happened, we know. We know they stole the election. We know how they stole the election. They converted honest Trump electors. They denied the Trump electors, and they took the Brandon electors. Okay. That's the coup. That's it. That's all it is. Okay. It's very simple. But those Trump electors are still out there. They haven't gone away. You know, and this is where it gets really fun, all right? Those Trump, in fact, they've tried to sue them. They've called them fake electors. They've called them alternate electors. They said that Trump's trying to overthrow the government with the Trump electors. All these things are happening. They're paranoid like crazy. They can't stand the fact these Trump electors are still there, because as long as those Trump electors exist, as long as they can't kill them all. That would look kind of suspicious, don't you think? All right? So as long as these Trump electors, which would give the election to Trump, 316 to 220 in the electoral college count, as long as those Trump electors are out there, they are the proof that, you know, this is a coup. This is an illegal government. Just as all the people that were cured by hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin prove that COVID vaccines are bogus and were never needed. So they can't tell you about those people. They're always silent. That's why they censor you on social media. In fact, this show, you know, we're so censored now, they don't have to worry about censoring us further. But it's going to get out. In fact, the fun part is once we break out big nationally, you know, people are going to go back and listen to all the things we said, you know, like 6 months, a year ago. And they're going to go, wow, damn, those guys were right. Okay, so I'm right about this one, too. They are terrified. This is the January 6th committee is about not only about, you know, they say about keeping Trump from running. Nah, that's only part of it. You know, he's going to run anyway. They know he's going to run. The real January 6th committee, the real action of the media, the deep state, and all these folks here, the Republicans and Democrats in the deep state, their sole occupation right now is keeping the Trump electors from being certified. Because once they're certified, Brandon is out and their asses are in jail. That's it. Let me tell you what happened yesterday. Or it was a Saturday. So here's CNN.
You need to.
Yeah. Did I miss something?
You need to explain one more time. Oh. Why those electors exist, because people probably didn't catch all of it.
I will. Actually, that's a really good point. I want to go through the CNN article with Stephen Miller, because that sets the scene. I brought back the old Knightsbridge article, the really good one that explains it perfectly. I was going to cover that next. So stay tuned for coming attractions. Yeah, but you're absolutely right, and I should go through that. Yeah, anything else you think I'm missing, please let me know. Let me document this, because this sets the scene. So the number one enemy of the deep state right now are the Trump electors. And the number one person pushing the Trump electors is Stephen Miller. Stephen Miller got subpoenaed by the Justice Department. So here's a deep state twiddly, Sarah Murray on CNN, published 4:23 p.m. Eastern Time, Saturday, September 10th. So this is 3 days ago. Wait, Tuesday? Yeah, okay. So Stephen Miller, they got a picture right there. You know, and here's the caption, President Donald Trump's senior advisor for policy, Stephen Miller, speaks during daily briefing of the White House. This is August 2 of 2017. So they got a nice little picture from there. So CNN, Dateline, let me get my Dateline music. I already played my other theme here, so let me get the newsroom thing up here really quickly, because this is kind of cool. I got to be able to find these things faster. And now, Dateline, now to the newsroom. Let's see what's happening down there. There we go. CNN. Last Saturday. Twiddly Sarah Murray says, Stephen Miller, a former White House speechwriter and senior advisor under President Donald Trump, has been subpoenaed by the Justice Department, a source tells CNN. Well, Pianki, what do you think that source would be? what source would tell CNN that the Justice Department has subpoenaed Stephen Miller? I don't know. What do you think? The Justice Department, maybe?
It's a toss-up.
In other words, who do they think they're kidding? This is so funny. They really treat us like idiots. So the Justice Department told CNN that they're subpoenaing Stephen Miller. Well, why don't they do that? He's out of office. He has no power. He's running a PAC. Ooh, Save America PAC. So the next sentence says, the department is the department, right? That's the Justice Department, which is really, this is the biggest oxymoron right now. It's like jumbo shrimp, okay? Justice Department? Please. So the KGB, FBI, is seeking information about the Save America PAC, alleged, quote, fake electors, in quotation marks, and communications between Miller and a long list of people. Well, who do you think that long list of people would be? I don't know, the electors themselves, maybe? Trump campaign donors? People in the Trump administration who know they should be in office right now? Who do you think that long list of people might be? And why do you think the Justice Department would want to know that long list of people and fake electors? I'll let you put the two and two together here. Bianchi, why do you think? He's thinking. Of course, this is live radio. I'd have to say something. Okay, I'll go back. I'll tell you the answer. Because they want to intimidate them. They want to send the FBI to their homes. They want to make the Trump electors recant. They want to make them deny that they're Trump electors. They want them so scared that they'll disavow Trump. They want them to be Judas Iscariot. They want them to disavow Trump. I didn't support Trump. I'm not a Trump elector. No, not me. Uh-uh, leave me alone. Don't invade my home. Don't shoot my dog. Don't burst in my door at 3 in the morning when I'm in my underwear. Don't do that. And that's what's going on, I think. This is an intimidation to try and get the Trump electors, the last vestige of honesty left, the people that can truly correct the election, the Trump electors, if the states would have the balls to put them forward and decertify Brandon, these are the people standing in the way of a total coup. And so
the
Justice
Department should do a video.
Go ahead.
They should do a video testimony. So that it's a record of their feeling in case those other sides try to do something nefarious to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, fortunately, the other side published all their names. I know who they are. I've got an article. I've got it in my file. They published the names of all the Trump electors because it's public record of who they are. Same thing with the Brandon electors. It's public record of who they are, too. Of course, they shall be arrested. But, well, actually, it's not their fault. It's the fault of the states, the governors, to put them forward. But anyway. So the Trump electors are known. Everybody knows who they are. In fact, they're all trying to have them all jailed. I'm surprised they haven't been – quite honestly, I'm surprised they haven't been arrested. But they don't have a pretense like January 6th. They can't call them insurrectionists. They were simply appointed by the state legislatures. They can't arrest the state legislatures because that's federal government people. I mean, fellow government people. They tend not to arrest, you know, fellow government people because the government reinforces the government even when they're wrong. Take a look at any bureaucracy. They'll go to the death saying that they are right even when they know they're wrong. So the fake electors. So this is what got me curious, because I know that most Americans, you say, well, what about the Trump electors? Huh? What are you talking about? You know, do you think the Trump electors are fake electors? What are Trump electors? You know, most people have already accepted that Brandon is supposed to be there. So if the people have accepted it, what are they worried about? Why would they worry about Trump electors if everything's settled as far as the public is concerned? So something's going on.
Well, those country electors were sent forth by the legislators of those countries, quote unquote states.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It took me a minute to remember what you're doing there. Yeah, for folks that don't know, we're not calling them states anymore. We're calling them countries. So the country of Arizona, the country of New Mexico, the country of Michigan, the country of Wisconsin, the country of Georgia, and the country of Pennsylvania have all said, there's one more, New Mexico. Let me see. New Mexico. Let me use my fingers here. Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, Georgia, Pennsylvania. What's the other one? I'm missing one. New Mexico. No, I think I said that already. New Mexico, Arizona. There's seven. I keep counting six. I'm missing one. There's another state in there somewhere. Anyway, I'll get to the other article. But the point is that those Trump electors are still valid electors. They've never been decertified by the states. Isn't that interesting? So they're still out there. And that's what stands in the way of a total coup. So it says the department is seeking information about Save America PAC, because that's where the money is. That's Trump's PAC. Okay, Save America, right? Then it says CNN has previously reported, and this is underlined for emphasis, that a federal grand jury is examining the Save America leadership PAC. That'd be Stephen Miller, you know, one of former President Donald Trump's main political and fundraising vehicles, instead of saying organizations, they say vehicles, in an expansion of the criminal investigation into the events surrounding the U.S. Capitol attack on January 6th. See, it all comes back to January 6th. So what they're saying is the Trump electors aren't valid. the Save America PAC is a criminal organization because they supported the insurrection on January 6th. That's what they're trying to, paint that picture. That's the narrative, right? But we all know January 6th was the Capitol Hill Invitational walk-in. We know that Ray Epps and a bunch of FBI operatives brought people into the Capitol with the permission of the Capitol Hill police, who opened the doors and took away the signs of the restricted areas and had a guy in a megaphone up top yelling, come on down, like the price is right. Come on in. This is your Capitol. Time for a little tour. Come on in. Welcome to the Capitol. I mean, those Capitol Hill police weren't police. They were greeters. They stand at the doors, greeters. Come on in. You know, that's not an insurrection. That's an invitation. There's a difference, okay? So that's why I call it the Capitol Hill Invitational Walk-In, because it's exactly what it was. So they made the Trump supporters sit on top of the Capitol so they could conduct the coup underneath and switch the Trump electors for Brandon electors, twist enough arms so there were no electoral challenges. So they spent 7 hours twisting arms. Then they came back up top. Once they had all the ducks in a row and they had all the members of the House and the Senate, they had enough people convinced to not raise any challenges, you know. So that was what they had to do. It wasn't that they needed a majority vote, because they already had that. There was 147 House members and 12 senators that were going to object. So they already had the majority vote. See, that wasn't the point. I just thought of this just now. The point was they needed enough arms twisted to not even have these states come up for a challenge. Bianca, we never talked about this. I think I'm breaking some new ground here. So the real coup, as I expand my definition and think about this more and more, that they had to stop the states from being challenged. So they couldn't have even one senator and one representative. See, if only one wants to challenge, there was no challenge. But as long as there weren't two, one senator and one House representative per state to challenge, there would be no challenge. And there were no challenges when they came back in session 7 hours later. So they twisted enough arms that there were no challenges to the Brandon insurrection. Now, here's where it gets even more interesting. Mike Pence presided over his own loss of the vice presidency. That's never been brought up. What kind of idiot or deep state operative would actually give away the vice presidency and end their political career? Why would anybody do that? How come he's never complained that his vice presidency was stolen by Brandon in the coup? Well, because he took part in it.
I think
that's
Pence
his confession.
Confused.
What's that?
I think Pence has a brain lapse.
Or, let me give you another possibility. That was his proof to the deep state that he was loyal and he deserved the presidency. He sacrificed himself. He sacrificed Trump, because he didn't care about Trump. But he sacrificed his own vice presidency, has never challenged the election. In fact, just the opposite. He certified the Brandon electors illegally. They should have gone at least either back to the states or to Congress. He had two possibilities. He didn't do either one. And that was his crime. He was duty-bound, constitutionally bound, to either send those electors back to the states and say, send me one set, or send it to the House of Representatives for a vote.
Send them back to the country. Yeah, they should have went back to the country where they came from.
Yep. Meaning the states, for those that don't know that we're using the term country now, the country of New Mexico, the country of California. And that's so that you get it in your brains. We say it often enough, everybody will think of these places as countries and not just states. And that's the difference. Because state is part of something else. Even though did you ever read my article on the city-state? I put it in the Action Radio group. I don't know if you had a chance to take a look at it. Let's keep going, because we're kind of a bit behind the curve here. But this is how it all ties in, okay? And this is what I find so fascinating about this. Then it says, there has been no evidence publicly that Miller has any involvement in the fake electors plot. What do you mean plot? It's not a plot. It's a constitutional procedure. So as far as I'm concerned, we're still back at January 6th. We're still waiting for the state challenges. But they never happened because they twisted the arms. So Mike Pence at least should have said, well, wait a minute. We've had a disturbance today. We've had a problem. Let's come back tomorrow and do the challenge properly. That's what he should have said. He had a third option. He didn't take that one either. All right, so he's up to his neck in coup. And he thinks he's going to get the Republican nomination. He's going to try for it. You watch. He's going to run. It's going to be the same old pattern. Mike Pence will be the moderate that can win against all these conservatives and beat the Democrat. And then the Democrat wins. That was the pattern with Mitt Romney, who threw the election after the first debate, which he obviously won, threw it to Obama. John McCain was the moderate that could beat Obama. Of course, he didn't, because that wasn't the plan. Jeb Bush in 2020 was supposed to be the moderate who could beat Hillary Clinton, and he was going to lose to her. That was the plan. The next plan is Mike Pence, the moderate, against all the conservatives who are going to run for president, although I don't think anybody is because of Trump, but he's going to be the moderate that can beat Hillary Clinton, and he's supposed to lose to her. That's the plan. That's what they always do. What throws a monkey wrench?
Another term for moderate is the great compromiser, because when you go to the table with all your cards, when you leave, you got half of them because you gave them away.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, makes sense. Well, and I don't know what cards he has left to play other than his loyalty to the deep state. You know, and of course they can keep asking. You know, if you sell your soul to the devil, you know, who's to say when the devil is done with you? Well, that's what he's done. He sold his soul to the devil. He sold his soul to the deep state, thinking the deep state will take care of him. Well, it's not going to work out that way, Mike Pence. You're going to go down in history as a traitor. All right. According to sources familiar, back to the article, multiple sources familiar with the subpoenas, well, now it's plural, which were issued by a grand jury in Washington, D.C., which is all done secret, unfortunately. The Justice Department, the KGB FBI, is seeking information related to the formation, fundraising, and expenditures of Save America, which has amassed more than $100 million in contributions since it was formed in November of 2020. Yeah, like right after the election was formed because it was stolen. So why would they want to do this? Well, my answer is they want to cut off the money to the Trump PAC. They don't want anybody contributing to the Trump PAC. They want to stop Trump in any way possible from winning the 2024 election. So they're going after Stephen Miller. They're going to go after other people in the Save America PAC, and they're going to try and stop donors from contributing to hurt Trump's reelection effort. That's what I think this is all about, while protecting the Brandon electors, which are the frauds, and intimidating the hell out of the Trump electors and making them disavow, decertify, or trying to have the states decertify the Trump electors. That's what this all is, because the Trump electors, that's the proof that Brandon lost. That's what I think. And I'm standing by it. All right. Pianki, any comments before I proceed?
No, just make sure you put that article in your chat room so people can read it.
It's already in the special investigations page. All this stuff is on my page, but it's for friends only because I don't want people screwing my page. But it's in the special investigations page. And I can put it in the regular Action Radio group page. It's easy to find. CNN. Just Google it. CNN. You know, Stephen Miller under subpoena. Find it in about 5 seconds. Now, here's the good article. This is the one I've kept for a long time. In fact, I even copied it in case they try and scrub it from the internet. Knightsbridge. The seven battleground states each sent Republican electors that voted for President Trump. Paul Ebeling, December 18th, 2020. So this is right after the December 14th Electoral College vote. That was fraudulent. But it also created two electors. Let me just read the article. So here's the background that Pianki was asking about earlier. This is how it works. Presidential candidates in the United States win elections by winning the most electoral votes. That's the Electoral College. It says the Electoral College system apportions a certain number of votes to each state. When voters in a state vote for a party's candidate, they are casting a vote for that party's slate of electors. Those electoral votes are counted by Congress. If a candidate gets 270 or more, he win the presidency. Well, it should be he or she wins the presidency, but that's okay. We'll get over that. On 14th December, this is on December 14th, seven states sent a slate of Democratic electors, chose Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. Republican electors also cast votes for President Trump. So the Democrats sent a slate of Brandon electors, I think fraudulently because he lost. And the Republicans sent what I think are the correct electors because Trump won. To Congress. So you got two sets of electors. Right? Well, you got to do something about that. You can't just count one. You got to put it through the process, right? And then the article says, thus creating seven sets of dueling electors or all alternates. That's where they're calling them alternate electors. I don't think that's a good term because it says that if you're an alternate, it's like an alternate juror. You're not really a juror. You're usually the alternate. You're there in case somebody gets sick. That's not the case here. These are seven sets of dueling electors or double electors. Let's go with that. It says both groups are sending certificates of ascertainment, in other words, certified, to Congress, which is slated to convene a joint session on January 6th, 2021, to count electoral votes. So the votes, the electors cast their votes on December 14th. Those votes were to be counted January 6th. Well, guess what happened? They weren't counted. They approved Brandon anyway. So you got so what's left over are the Trump electors. That's the pesky little problem that won't go away. Okay, that's why this is so fascinating. Nobody's really talking about this, so this is where I'm covering it. Then it says alternate electors are unusual, but they have happened in our history. The last time was in the 1960 election, when the governor of Hawaii certified electors for Republican Richard Nixon. Democrat electors cast their votes for Democrat John Kennedy. A subsequent recount determined Kennedy won the state, and he was declared the winner in the joint session in 1961. Now think about that. A subsequent recount determined Kennedy won the state. What's the one thing that hasn't happened in the battleground states? A proper recount. They've counted the fraudulent electors, the fraudulent ballots, but they've never had a proper recount. They've never kicked out all the fraudulent ballots and counted the remaining good ones.
Yeah, let's say that one more time. They keep counting, and that's what happened. They kept counting the ballots, which included the fraudulent ballots.
That's right.
So if you kick out the fraudulent ballots, which they should have done, those that was not properly vetted, or should I say qualified, they weren't qualified to be included in the count because they were fraud, then Trump would have won.
But here's the problem, though. They've disguised the ballots. They mixed in illegally, even against judges' orders, they mixed in the fraud ballots with the good ones. There's no way to tell. There's no way to know. So the only thing you can do is disqualify entire congressional districts, like Mariposa County, for fraud. You have to disqualify entire districts, battleground districts, for fraud. Because they photograph, we've got this on video, they photographed the same ballot, you know, a gazillion times. Ballots were brought out from under desks. Mail order ballots. Ballots were sent out in California to everybody. I mean, how many illegal aliens filed ballots? How many signatures were not verified? The affidavits of the truckloads of ballots coming in fraudulently that were mixed in. This is why they stopped the count at 10 o'clock, kicked out all the Republican observers, blocked the windows, and committed their fraud. That fraud was to mix in the fraudulent ballots with the good ones, so there's no way to tell the difference, hoping that nobody would ever count them. Well, the proper remedy, of course, is to discount that whole ballot counting precinct. Detroit, throw it out. You have to, because you can't tell, because they committed the crime of vote fraud, of mixing fraudulent ballots with good ones, you have to throw out all the ballots in that precinct, in that counting area, in that district, whatever it might be. It's the only way to do it. It's the only way to get rid of the fraud ballots. You know, so you just don't count them. And they only did it in very specific places. Strategically, they had specific districts. Fulton County, Georgia, which is Atlanta. Whatever the county is in Michigan, this Detroit. Mariposa County in Arizona, which is Phoenix. Always the big cities, always the corrupt Democrat big cities. That's where the vote fraud took place. Because it's easy.
And let's explain that a little bit better.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's explain it for those who are listening. Because people think that if you and I, if you are Trump and I'm whoever, that if you get 500 and I get 400, you win. But within your account, there's ballots that should not be there. Mm-hmm. So if you took the ballots that should not be there, then you would have 350 and I would have 400. And people are under the misconstrued notion that the count, whether it includes the fraud and the good, is the count that gave Brandon the presidency, and that's wrong.
Well, the count gave it to Trump initially. In fact, when they were counting properly, when everything was being observed, you know, the count up till 10 o'clock at night. In fact, that's the one that I think they should be mandated to take. Anything that happened after the polls were blocked or closed or the observers kicked out, none of those votes can count. So, and they know what the count was because it was announced, you know. So everybody knows what the count was. So Trump clearly won based on the legal count alone at 10 o'clock at night, you know, when they had, or whatever the time zone was, you know, whatever you're in. Once those ballots, you know, those Trump was way ahead everywhere. That's the only legitimate count. The minute they kicked out the observers, the minute they blocked the windows, the minute they did anything and switched it from a Trump lead to a Brandon lead, none of those votes should count. Those are all illegal votes because you don't know which votes were thrown out for Trump. You don't know how many extra ones were added for Brandon. You've got districts, you know, where 130% of the people voted. Well, that's interesting. How do you have 130% of the people vote? Well, those are fraudulent votes. Because normally in a primary, what, 30-40% of a precinct or a district will vote in a primary? It's really low. Presidential elections only have 50 or 60% of the population votes. Primaries are even lower. So if you have 150% of the people voting in a precinct, that means you have 50% extra votes beyond the number of people that are even there eligible to vote. So all these things are vote fraud. Ballot box stuffing, mail order. How do you know you've got Democrat union members running the post offices? You know, if there's any way to tell a Republican ballot, they can dump it. Or all they have to do is dump the ballots from areas that are predominantly Republican. You can do that too. So all these different ways to vote fraud. The only way to have a successful election is votes have to be counted or cast. They have to be on paper ballots. They have to go through, if any machine is used, it has to be an optical scanner with no transmission capability whatsoever. The votes are recorded and published at the precinct level. Then they're sent in, and that's it. No ballot goes anywhere, nor does it come in, except by a voter. That's it. That's the only way to have a very
and
valid election.
And you know the thing?
Uh-huh.
With the insertion of all these undocumented illegal aliens into these districts, into these states, into these countries,
yep,
you're going to have to separate those ballots, the federal ballot from the state and local ballot, because these locals, like we've seen all the villainous activity mm-hmm. that's going on in New York, they're trying to let these illegals vote. And if they're voting down ballot, surely they're going to travel up ballot to put a mark by your federal candidacies, and they
exactly.
should not be doing
it. Yeah, because the ballot doesn't identify you by name. So even if they have a section, illegal aliens vote here only, it's not going to fly. Well, of course, the thing is not to have illegal aliens vote. I mean, Josie has a bill for voter fingerprint voter ID, which I agree with. You know, at the polls, you know, get the thumbprint. Let's see if you are who you say you are. And that would cancel your vote in any other place. And then your bill to separate the ballots, federal and state. Yeah, I think they're both critical.
Well, since the mob came up with a way to alter fingerprints, let's go with a more technological advanced method, and that's the iris in your eyes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not crazy about biometric measuring of people. It'd be nice to think that the passport actually works, you know, or that a government ID works, but there's no way to know because driver's licenses aren't valid. The only valid citizenships, I think, are the passport. And, of course, I still have my naturalization papers, but I don't want to carry them with me. I'd rather have a card. So it would be nice to have a certified card. So what we really need is a citizenship card. You know, and that's why I have my citizenship ID thing. Or a driver's license have to have a valid citizenship identification portion. Otherwise, they can't be issued. So there are ways that we need to do this, but we got to find out who the honest people are. But the other thing, too, is just to kick out the illegal aliens with civil asset forfeiture to make it impossible for them to live here. The fewer illegal aliens in our country, you know, the less vote fraud there's going to be. So that's going to help, too. So you're never going to eliminate vote fraud. What's that?
All these steps need to be put in place. Each and every last one of them. Fingerprints, asset forfeiture, biometric identification. All of them, because apparently somebody wants to control the presidency in the United States.
Well, now, isn't it interesting that it's the deep state, the business as usual, the corrupt elite, you know, the globalists? They don't give a damn about this country because they don't care. As long as they have money and power, this is what inflation's about. Inflation transfers money and power to them. You know, it takes it away from us. You know, because we're losing 8% of our money. Where do you think that 8% is going? It's going to the Federal Reserve and the banks and the government people that take advantage of cheap money, and we have to spend a whole bunch more to get money, but they get it first. So it's a transfer of wealth. It lowers the government debt. You know, if you have a debt of $30 trillion and you print $30 trillion, you basically cut that national debt in half because now you got all that extra money floating around. But yet the inflation that causes bankrupts, you know, a whole bunch of people. I'm not exactly sure how it works. I still have to work on a good explanation for that. But the point is that inflation is all government. And it's not the rise in prices. You're going to hear the consumer price. It's probably already out. The consumer price index. They're going to say, well, inflation's up, you know, 8-9%. No, inflation's actually up about 40%. I've got an article about that I'm going to talk about Friday. It's about 40%.
Well, you know,
maybe tomorrow. But the inflation of the money supply is about 40%. It hasn't caught up yet with the prices. They're only up about 8%, but they will. Go ahead.
Yeah, and the people is blaming and saying, well, products and goods was at the offshore because they couldn't come into the ports. Therefore, it caused an increase in prices.
Yeah, supply chain.
Yeah, but if there's nothing on the shelf to sell, how are you going to increase the price on something that's not there?
Well, the fact that it's not there increases the price because, you know, supply and demand, the smaller the
but what do you got to sell to increase the price? There's no bread, so you can't raise the price of a loaf of bread if it ain't no bread on the shelf.
No, but whatever bread – see, there's never none. It's like there is some baby formula out there, but it's probably prohibitively expensive at this point because it's so rare. You know, it's like if all the diamonds in the world were released – price of diamonds would plummet because there's a lot of diamonds out there, a lot of diamonds, but they don't release them. So they keep the price artificially in the thousands and thousands of dollars. But industrial diamonds are used all the time. Every drill, every concrete drill is a diamond.
Well,
diamond drill is probably
your
teeth are. I think the dentist drill
those
is diamond.
Diamonds are diamonds you can't do nothing with.
Well, I know, but
diamonds,
they're still
they
diamonds,
awful.
But they start with bigger diamonds and they crush them into little ones.
Yeah, the little pieces, rather than throw them away, they put them in the tip of concrete bits.
Yeah, exactly. Let's get back to this article.
Concrete drill.
We've got 10 minutes technically, but you know what? I think we're going to run a little bit over here. I love having the extra. So let's go back to the recount. So in other words, if the seven battleground states had proper recounts where they'd thrown out the ballots from districts that were known fraud took place, Trump would have easily won. And that would have solved the situation because the Brandon electors would have been discounted and disqualified because Trump would easily have won the election. So if they had a proper count, made Trump the, you know, sent the Trump electors in, Trump would have won 316 to 222, and a conversation January 6th becomes a formality, and Trump would be in the office. They didn't do that. They cheated. They didn't have – you notice there's been no real recount in any state, not even Arizona. They had an audit. But they never did a proper recount. They still haven't gotten to count the ballots except for where they had the vote fraud in Mariposa County in Phoenix. Why haven't they done that? Geldings, bunch of weenies. So proper recounts would have solved it. So all along the way, there are places where this could have been solved. If the Supreme Court had taken the Texas case, if the other courts have actually looked at the evidence, if Mike Pence wasn't Mike Pence, if he was, you know, Donald Trump Jr. or if you were Kelly Lake, you know, or Kerry Lake, you know, or anybody, you know, Sarah Palin. We're running with Trump, okay? She would have sent the electors back for a proper count, and Trump electors would have won, or Trump would have won, and the Trump electors would have come in a conversation. January 6th is, like, no big deal. But that's not what happened. Anyway, so then it says, in this election, this is my Knightsbridge article from right after, from December, I think it was 18th of 2020. It says, so we got past the recount part. So this is, in this election, there is historical precedent, and in each of the seven states, there is pending litigation challenging the results of the election. Well, I'm guessing it's still pending because I can't find anything current. I've looked. I looked at the current status of the Trump electors. Nobody's talking about them. So this is still the best article, even though it was written back in 2020, right after the electoral vote. This says, if that litigation is successful, then the Trump electors, having met and voted, would have their votes certified. Okay, sorry. These guys sent some misprints. So they didn't proof their article. So would have their votes certified and be the number one properly counted in the joint session of Congress on January 6th. So in other words, what they're saying is, although they screwed up the English in this article, if they'd counted the states properly, if they've thrown out the fraudulent ballots, the Trump electors would be the only ones that could be certified because Trump won. Those would have been sent in, and January 6th, they would have counted the Trump electors, and again, the vote count would have been 316 to 220. But again, that's not what happened. So let's go back and see what happened. It says the electoral votes have been officially counted, and the votes have been sent along. There is nothing to be done until the matter gets to Congress, because they didn't do it properly, because the states let two sets of electors go to Congress. They should not have done that. That was another mistake. All the way through, there's mistakes. So let's break down the states. This is, I think, the most interesting part. In three of the seven states in question, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, Republicans control the state legislatures while Democrats hold the governor's posts. I would assume in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, the legislature sent in Trump delegates and the Democrat governors sent in Brandon electors. That's what I think happened. Because it only makes sense, right? In Georgia and Arizona, Republicans control both. That would be the legislatures and the governorship. And New Mexico and Nevada, Democrats control both. So Nevada and New Mexico, I'm pretty sure, you know, if they had two slates of electors, the Brandon electors were sent for it. And, well, you wouldn't even have them there, I wouldn't think. We'll see what it says. It says, according to the Congressional Research Service, when dueling slates are received, members of Congress in the joint session consider the list when it's from a different state authority than the certified list and conduct a vote. Acceptance of either slate would then require a concurrent agreement in both the House and the Senate. If there is no conflict in terms of state authority, the one determined to be appointed pursuant to the state's election laws is counted. If there's no determination by a state authority of which slate was lawfully appointed, the two chambers agree concurrently to accept the votes of one set or decide not to accept either set. That would be the House and the Senate of Congress. If the two chambers do not agree, the electors certified by the state's governor shall be counted. See, I think that's wrong. After electors cast their votes this week, focus has been turned to the upcoming joint session, which takes place just 3 days after the newly elected members of Congress are sworn in. Okay, this is a little complicated, but the key, I think, is right here. Three of the seven states in question, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Republicans control the state legislatures. They would have sent in Trump electors. So I got three for Trump, right? In the governor's post in Georgia and Arizona, Republicans control both the governors and the legislature. So now you got five of the seven states sent in Trump electors that should have been counted because they're from the legislatures. What's that?
Who's watching over that governor to make sure that they do the right thing?
I don't know.
I.e. Stacey Abrams, if she becomes governor.
That's a good question. But I'm pretty assured that five of those seven states, the ones that had both, that had Republican state legislatures and Republican governors, three of them had Republican governors and legislatures, two of them did. Oh, it's getting confusing. In the three of the seven states in question, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Republicans control the state legislatures. So three state legislatures would have sent in Trump electors, and those should have been counted because legislatures control the electors, which is right there in the Constitution. Then it says in Georgia and Arizona, Republicans control both the legislature and the governorship, so they definitely would have sent in Trump electors. There's five of the seven states. And New Mexico and Nevada, Democrats control both. So even though Republicans might have sent in an alternate slate, Democrats are going to be counted in New Mexico and Nevada. So you got five states where the Republican legislatures and two of those where they have governors too sent in Trump electors that should have been counted. And that's more than enough to over 270. So it's very confusing, but that's where we stand. Now, the current electoral count is Biden 3. The fraudulent count is Biden 306, Trump 232. That's not even close to being true. And the reason that is because the Trump electors were not counted by Mike Pence and by the Congress when they should have been. Whew. It's a lot. A lot going on. I'm beat already. I haven't even gotten my other articles yet. I think I'll save it for another day. Yeah, I'll probably pick
it up
tomorrow.
Well, if this doesn't get straightened out, then I don't know what to say where we're going. But you know, similar things supposedly happened during the ratification of the 13th, 14th Amendment.
Not the 14th. Well, I think you're thinking of the 17th is the one that took the election away from the states. State legislatures. The income tax is the one that everybody thinks was fraudulently done. I think the 13th and 14th were done just fine. 13th ended slavery.
No,
and 14th is
according to the Federal Register, the count that it was not there.
On the 13th,
you know, you
the
can
14th?
Go back today and look at the Federal Register.
Oh, I've actually used the debate on the 14th Amendment on several shows to prove the subject to the jurisdiction clause from the people that wrote it. Yeah, I'm going to pick this up tomorrow. I want to talk about the – so what I want to do tonight, I'm going to see if I can trace exactly where those electors are, whether the governor's approved, whether the state's approved, whether the state legislature's approved. What is the status of the Trump electors? Because that's the thing that the left is so against. They're saying, no, those don't count, you know, and we know they do.
Yeah, what is the procedure for a governor approving? Do a governor approve as is deliberate, or do they have some means to alter, i.e. safety image?
I think that, well, no, I don't think it's a problem. I think the problem is even in other states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Arizona, that the states, that the governors approved things that they weren't entitled to approve. Let's go back and see if I can trace it again. I'm kind of beat right now. It's been a long morning. Let me see if I can just, I'll go through it carefully. Acceptance. All right, so let's go back here. According to the Congressional Research Service, when dueling slates are received, members of Congress in the joint session consider the list when it's from a different state authority than the certified list and conduct a vote. Okay, so the certified list should be the state legislature, but maybe the governors rule in different states. It might depend on the state, and that's why this is confusing. Then it says if there is no conflict.
Isn't that the controversy?
Yeah, which electors are valid? That's the controversy. That's it right there. But that's what they should have considered in Congress. Which electors are valid? The Brandon ones or the Trump ones? And my contention is the Brandon ones can't be valid if Brandon lost in that state if you do a proper count, tossing out the fraudulent votes. See, that's what changes all this. So if the proper count is done, it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter who's the controlling authority because, you know, the winner is going to have their electors count. So if the states did proper counts, throwing out the fraudulent votes and proved that Trump won, which shouldn't be that hard to do, then the Brandon ones are automatically tossed because Trump won. But see, they
did
that
article name the state?
Yeah. Well, I'll see. Let me go through it again. In three of the seven states in question, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, Republicans control the state legislatures, while Democrats hold the governor posts in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. In Georgia and Arizona, Republicans control both the governor and the legislature. And in New Mexico and Nevada, Democrats control both. Then it says, according to the Congressional Research Service, when dueling slates are received, members of Congress in the joint session consider the list when it's from a different slate state authority than the certified list and conduct a vote. Acceptance of either state slate, would then require a concurrent agreement in both the House and the Senate. That's what they're supposed to do January 6th. That's what January 6th is all about when they consider each state. If there is no conflict in terms of state authority, the one determined to be appointed pursuant to the state's election laws is counted. So if the state election laws say that the state legislature counts, which is what the Constitution says, then that counts. If the state election laws say no, the governor certifies, then maybe the governor counts, even though it should be the state legislatures per the Constitution. So state legislatures, I guess, can, what's that word I'm trying to think of, delegate their power to the governor to certify the electors. I think that's a huge mistake. But if that's what the state, so the state law controls, state legislatures control the elections. If the states delegate the certification to the governor, then the governor would control it per the state legislatures who gave the governor that power. So that's very possible, too, in some of these states. Then it says, if there is no determination by a state authority of which slate was lawfully appointed, in other words, the dueling electors, the two chambers agree concurrently to accept the votes of one set or decide not to accept either set. That would be Congress. Congress, the legislatures have to, you know, discuss it. That's what the January 6th state challenge is supposed to be about. Each state was considered, and the battleground states especially. The states where there's no challenge, like Florida and Texas, Trump won. It's no big deal. Those you know, any objections? Nah, go ahead, next state. But the battleground states are the ones that had to be considered. Those seven states are the ones that had to be debated in Congress. And the whole point of the January 6th Trump Invitational walk-in was to stop that debate, was to stop debate on those seven states. That's what it was about. And this is why. Because they didn't want the Brandon electors challenged because Brandon would have lost. All right. At least four in the House. Okay. Then it says, after electors cast their votes this week, that'll be December of 2020, focus has turned to the upcoming joint session, which takes place just 3 days after the newly elected Congress members are sworn in. Then it says at least four people who will be in the House, Representative Mo Brooks, Alabama, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, Barry Moore of Alabama, and Bob Good of Virginia, have committed to filing objections during the session. So those four representatives were going to object to the Brandon electors from the battleground states. So they're already going to challenge them. So now all you need was four senators. Then it says objections must be made in writing at least by one representative and one senator. No senators have committed to objecting yet. Well, actually, 14 did commit, and 147 House members did commit to objecting to the battleground states' dual electors. That we know. That's in the news. I've got the count on that somewhere. Anyway, Then it says objections. Okay. The basis for an objection is that the electoral vote or votes were not regularly given by an elector and or the elector was not lawfully certified. We'll say, there you go. So the elector was not lawfully certified, which means the Brandon electors, by a fraudulent vote, could not be lawfully certified because it was a fraudulent vote. But the states would have to show that, and they haven't. And that's according to the Congressional Research Service. Then it says, if an objection meets the requirements, the joint session is suspended, and each chamber withdraws to meet and debate the objection and choose whether to vote or uphold it. So when did the Capitol Hill walk-in disruption start? Do you remember January 6th? When did the problem start? And this is where timing is critical.
Well, wonder why come these legislatures don't do the right thing.
Well, because they're cowards and geldings. But when the problems, just to answer my own question, the time that the problem started in Congress, January 6th, was when Arizona, the first state alphabetically of the battleground states, came up for a challenge. And that's when they came crashing through the doors and the windows, and that's when they came through the Congress, and that's when all the FBI operatives, you know, got as many people as they could into the Capitol because they had to stop the Arizona challenge. That was part of the coup also. So you'll notice if you look at the tapes, it was Arizona, the first battleground state alphabetically, when it came up for a challenge, that's when the Congress was suspended. And the Congress folks went downstairs to be victims of the coup. The Trump supporter stays upstairs taking selfies. Ashley Babbitt was murdered by Michael King. Maybe it goes Lieutenant Michael King. Maybe it goes middle letter wrong. But I think it's Michael J. King assassinated Ashley Babbitt. And they call it an insurrection, and here we are. So that's what happened. But they stopped the session the minute Arizona came up for a challenge because they knew they couldn't have that challenge. They couldn't risk the Brandon electors being decertified by Congress. You know, one state, one vote. So they had to stop the session then. They could not let the session begin again. In fact, they've never had the electoral challenge to the states. Never. By focusing on January 6th and having these hearings and all the suspension stuff and all these arguments and everything else, the sole purpose of that is to stop the congressional electoral challenge that never took place. Make sense?
I'm going to have to start calling you Dick Tracy.
I just put together the pieces. It's not that hard. So we're still at January 6th.
There's another one. I'm sorry. Yeah.
What?
Scotland Yard. Greg Scotland Yard Pingus.
Well, that sounds good to me. Oh, maybe I should describe this in British terms. So today's election discussion from Scotland Yard. Yes, we have determined that the electors are still yet to be determined, but they're still out there. And that's why the title of the show, those pesky Trump electors won't give the deep state their coup. There cannot be a complete coup.
This is like an Alfred Hitchcock novel.
Yeah.
Suspense. Okay, I'm getting ready, Lee.
Okay, I'm getting ready. I'm going to play my Santa Rosa Volunteers piece, number 13, Andy Federalist, number 13. And here we go. So I'll play that. It's been fun, everybody. I'll have just a couple little announcements when I come back, and we'll be back tomorrow. Tomorrow's Wednesday, so 7 a.m. I'm going to pick up part two. We shall pick up part two of those pesky Trump electors won't go away. And I'll be back in a little bit. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Anti-Federalist Paper number 13 was written by our old anonymous friend, under the name A. Farmer. The paper is titled The Expense of the New Government, referring to the Constitution being considered for ratification on this date, October 17, 1787. In the first paragraph, A. Farmer complains about overpaid government bureaucrats, even from the Articles of Confederation. Regarding that, he says, "The truth is, when you carry a man's salary beyond what decency requires, he immediately becomes a man of consequence and does little or no business at all."
That pretty much explains our multi-trillion dollar bureaucrat welfare establishment workforce. They knew it even before our Constitution was ratified. The second paragraph starts with a call to action. It implores all to make sure that if the Constitution is ratified by the states, it must include a Bill of Rights. Sadly, it did not until many years later. But A. Farmer and the Anti-Federalists knew that without one, the Constitution was for the government and not for the people. He says, "Rouse up, my friends. A matter of infinite importance is before you on the carpet, soon to be decided in your convention. The new Constitution. Seize the happy moment. Secure to yourselves and your posterity the jewel liberty, which has cost you so much blood and treasure by a well-regulated Bill of Rights from the encroachments of men in power. For if Congress will do these things in the dry tree when their power is small, what won't they do when they have all the resources of the United States at their command?" Well, we all know what they would do. They would create a coup to steal the government and rule by the tyranny of mandates, none of which are legal, and all of which constitute the very insurrection they blame on the true government and those who support it. A. Farmer continues by describing the proper place of bureaucrats in relationship to the people in terms of what this paper is all about, that being the expense of government, in this case, people who work in it. He says, "They are the servants of the public. You have an undoubted right to set their wages, or at least to say, thus far, you and those under you may go and no further. This would, in the end, ease Congress of a great deal of trouble, as it would put a stop to the impertinence of individuals in asking large salaries." You can usually tell the evil or folly of a government program or law by how quickly the supporters want it passed, implemented, or in the case of the Constitution, ratified. The Federalists are always in such a hurry, spending much time on the urgency of ratifying the Constitution before the states all break into factions or various nations of Europe declare war on us. Both were fiction, but they served a purpose, much as the propagandized creation of the fear of COVID, which is as always to increase government power and control. A. Farmer says of this artificial urgency, "My friends and countrymen, let us pause for a moment and consider. We are not driven to such great straits as to be obliged to swallow down every potion offered us by wholesale or else die immediately by our disease. We can form a constitution at our leisure and guard and secure it on all sides. We are paying off our state debt and the interest on the domestic as fast as Congress call upon us for it. As to the foreign debt, they have the promise of more interest from us than they can get anywhere else, and we shall be able to pay them both interest and principal shortly. But it is said they win declare war against us if we don't pay them immediately. Common sense will teach them better. We live at too great a distance and are too hardy and robust a people for them to make money out of us in that way." A. Farmer then describes various economic classes, from merchants to soldiers to government folks who want public debt and paper money abolished. But whatever the economic consequences or benefits, this still remains the fundamental problem that the Constitution by itself fails to guard our liberty by prohibiting government from enacting certain laws, regulations, policies, or practices. A. Farmer says, "But in neither of these cases do I wish to see it adopted without being guarded on all sides with a Magna Carta or a Bill of Rights as a bulwark to our liberties." So the economic consequences of funding the government, its officers, the national debt, and interest are subordinate to the essential component of a bulwark to our liberties. And of that, the Federalists have not spoken to this point. A. Farmer continues. He says, regarding the Constitution, but we need not be in a hurry about it. Consider, my friends, you are the persons who must live and die by this Constitution. A merchant or mechanic may dispose of his goods or pack them up in trunks and remove it to another clime in the course of a few months. But you cannot shoulder your lands or dispose of them when you please. It therefore behooves you to rouse up and turn your most serious and critical attention to this Constitution. So ends part one. In part two, a farmer issues a warning to his fellow citizens, which is also a precursor to the tyranny of the deep state and their stolen government has imposed on this country by a coup d'etat. A farmer says, "A large representation has ever been esteemed by the best Whigs in Great Britain, the best barrier against bribery and corruption. And yet we find a British king having the disposition of all places, civil and military, and an immense revenue squeezed out of the very mouths of his wretched subjects, is able to corrupt the Parliament, devote him any supplies he demands to support armies, to defend the prerogatives of his crown, and carry fire and sword by his fleets and armies, to desolate whole provinces in the eastern world, to aggrandize himself and satisfy the avarice of his tyrannical subjects. Replace King with Brandon, and our plight will be accurately reflected in the history books." The next paragraph is so good, I just have to read it. A farmer says, "No wonder our American ambassador, John Adams, struck with the brilliancy of the British court, where everything around St. James wears the appearance of wealth, ease, and plenty, should imagine a three-branch legislature only can produce these effects and make the subjects happy, should write a book in favor of such a government and send it over for the illumination of this Western world. If this is the sole fruit of his embassy, America will not canonize him for a saint on account of his services, when they have experienced the consequences of such a kind of government as he has planned out. In order to have formed the right judgment, he should have looked into the ditches which serve for graves for many of the human race, under hedges which serve as dreary habitations for the living, into the cottages of the poor and miserable, and critically examine with how much parsimony the mechanics, the day laborers, cottagers, and villagers live in order to support their high pampered lords, before he had wrote a book to persuade his country to pursue the same road to greatness, splendor, and glory, and have reflected in his own mind whether he could wish to see that country which gave him birth reduced to the same situation." And here we are today. In conclusion, A. Farmer submits the question of whether it makes sense to rush into ratifying this Constitution before all the details have been spelled out. I agree, which is why Action Radio is sponsoring a constitutional amendment to take away the power of Congress to borrow money. Just one of many proposed overhauls planned to make the Constitution live up to its promise of limited government and no public debt. A. Farmer says, "Now I submit it to the good sense of the people of these states, whether it is prudent we should make so liberal and extensive a grant of power and property to any body of men in these United States before they have ever informed the public the amount of the public debt, or what the annual expenses of the federal government is or will be." The source for the Federalist and Anti-Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. Yeah, I know today's show is a little confusing. You might want to take some time to get your podcast and go over it.
and listen to the parts over again. But it's confusing for me, too. That's why I'm kind of stumbling over this electoral process. And so I have to go back to the states. I want to find out the status of each of the slates of electors, especially the Trump electors, where they are. And when we know the Brandon ones are. The Brandon ones have been counted and certified. But where are the Trump electors? What have the states done with them? So that's going to take a little challenge. I should have that done tomorrow. We've got Captain Tom Stewart coming back. We've got, you know, leading off with Bill Fecky of his report, Wendy Arthur with the Oh My God report, and our Wild Women of Wellness. Actually, I don't have time tomorrow. I think I'm busy all 3 hours, but we'll see. Maybe I'll bring it back Friday. Friday might be a good time to do that in the 8 o'clock hour. I've got some time then. So we'll do part two. Give me more chance to research where those Trump electors are. So let me just leave you a couple of messages, and I'll be back tomorrow, Wednesday at 7 a.m. Central Time, and we shall talk again. This is Greg Penglis. So what is Action Radio? It is a radio show with its own citizen legislature. That's you, the listener. It is a fully interactive system of listeners, expert guests, social media, writing bills, legislator input, bill submission, lobbying, and citizen action. Action Radio is the future of talk radio, using all the available technology in one completely integrated new system. You are listening to Action Radio Online with Greg Penglis. The webpage for all Action Radio shows and podcasts is blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Please share our show with all your friends and family, both nationally and internationally. The guiding principle of Action Radio is this: we the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed.